It's 2 o'clock, and it looks like we have a quorum. Good afternoon. I am Timothy Dawson, an administrative law judge designated by the Office of Administrative Hearings upon the request of the Public Service Commission to serve as hearing officer for this hearing. This is North Dakota Public Service Commission case numbers PU 19-306, 307, and 317. Please silence your cell phones before we begin today. This is the consolidated hearing on the application from Montana Dakota Utilities Company for an advanced determination of prudence and a certificate of public convenience and necessity to construct, own, and operate Heskett Unit Number 4. Heskett Unit Number 4 is a project for an 88 megawatt simple cycle combustion turbine located adjacent to the other Heskett units in Morton County near Mandan, North Dakota. In addition, this consolidated hearing is on the application of MDU for deferred accounting treatment of costs related to MDU's closure of Luce and Clark Unit 1 near Sidney, Montana, Heskett Units Number 1 and 2 in Morton County near Mandan, North Dakota, as well. MDU states these coal-fired power plants are no longer economical and wants to accelerate depreciation to an early retirement date. Let the record show that it is April 30th, 2020, and a little past 2 p.m. Central Time, and we are conducting a remote hearing through the telephone and internet due to the state of emergency caused by the COVID-19 pandemic. The hearing location was originally noticed on April 4th, 2020, for the Public Service Commission hearing room at the state capitol, Bismarck, North Dakota. This is the time, date, and place set by the amended notice of filing and public hearing issued by the North Dakota Public Service Commission on April 17th, 2020. There are two methods that people from the public may provide testimony today. You may provide this in writing, and you may do this through May 11th, 2020, to the commission through their email, ndpsc@nd.gov, or by mailing it to the PSC at 600 East Boulevard Avenue, Department 408, Bismarck, North Dakota, 58505-408. Today, if you'd like to provide telephonic testimony, that may be provided by calling 701-328-4081. Please call and leave your callback information, and you'll be called by the Public Service Commission staff when the public testimony portion of the hearing begins. The issues today to be determined under case number PU-19-306, the advanced determination of prudence are: 1. Whether MDU's proposed resource addition is prudent, and 2. Whether the Commission should grant MDU an advanced determination of prudence. The issues to be determined in case number PU-19-307, the Certificate of Public Convenience and Necessity, are: whether public convenience and necessity will be served by construction and operation of the facilities, and 2. Whether the applicant is fit, willing, and able to provide service. The issues to be considered in case number PU-19-317, the deferred accounting, are: whether MDU's proposed early plant retirements are reasonable and appropriate, and 2. Whether MDU's proposal for accelerated depreciation should be approved. We will now make appearances. Would the applicant, Mr. Sanderson, make an appearance for the record?
Thank you, Your Honor. This is Paul Sanderson of Evenson Sanderson and Bismarck on behalf of the applicant, Montana Dakota Utilities.
And how many witnesses do you plan on calling today?
We have two witnesses today, Your Honor. We intend to call Darcy Nigam, the Director of Electric Systems Operation and Planning, and Travis Jacobson, Montana Dakota's Director of Regulatory Affairs.
Okay. Would the advocacy staff please make an appearance? Mr. Armstrong.
Yes, Mitch Armstrong on behalf of Public Service Commission advocacy staff.
And I understand that we have advisory staff as well. Is Mr. Lean or is someone else taking that role?
Hey, Judge, this is John Hsu, and I'm advisory counsel in this case. Mr. Lien is available, or should be available as well, as advisory staff in this case.
Okay. Well, I said before that we will have public testimony today, and so if you're listening in on the internet or on telephone, please call in to the number I stated before, 701-328-4081, and get your name on the list to be called back when the public testimony portion of the hearing begins. But now it is time for opening comments by the commissioners. Commissioner Crotchis.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. I'll keep it very short. I look forward to going through the information today. I've got some questions, as you might expect. But I look forward to a productive hearing and welcome everyone.
Next, Commissioner Chrisman.
We'll pass on opening comments, but just look forward to hearing a few more details and then asking some questions. Thank you.
Commissioner Fedorchik.
Good afternoon, everybody. I don't have any opening comments either. Just get right into the hearing. Looking forward to it. Thank you.
Are there any preliminary matters or motions, Mr. Sanderson, Mr. Armstrong? Mr. Sanderson.
Your Honor, this is Paul Sanderson. At this time, we have both us and advocacy staff had agreed to an exhibit list and pre-filed exhibits. We would offer those at this time. Those include MDU Exhibit 1, MDU's application for ADP, MDU Exhibit 2, its application for deferred accounting in case PU 317, MDU Exhibit 3, the pre-filed testimony of Darcy Nigam, MDU Exhibit 4, the pre-filed testimony of Alan Welty, MDU Exhibit 5, the pre-filed Joseph Geiger adopted testimony of Alan Welty. MDU 6, the pre-filed testimony of Travis Jacobson. Staff Exhibit 1, pre-filed testimony of James Heidel. Staff Exhibit 2, the pre-filed testimony of Joel Jeanson, redacted. And a joint exhibit, the settlement agreement entered to by the parties.
Unless there's an objection, the exhibits will be so marked and admitted. Hearing no objection, they are admitted. At this time, you may begin with opening remarks or call your first witness, Mr. Sanderson.
Thank you, Judge. I begin with just a few opening remarks. First, thank you to the Commission and Commissioners for allowing us to be here this afternoon, especially by video conference. As the judge mentioned, Montana Dakota Utilities is the applicant in cases 19-306 and 19-307, seeking an advanced determination of prudence and a certificate of public convenience and necessity to construct, own, and operate an 88-megawatt simple cycle combustion turbine referred to as Heskett 4. Heskett 4 would be located adjacent to Montana Dakota's existing Heskett 3 88-megawatt combustion turbine near Mandan. Heskett 4 is necessary to meet the capacity requirements of Montana Dakota's electric service customers. Montana Dakota's 2019 Integrated Resource Plan filed with the Commission described both the need and justification for Heskett 4, and it is a least cost option for meeting a portion of the identified needs. Montana Dakota's applications, along with the attached pre-filed testimony exhibits and the testimony of his witnesses today, establish that public convenience and necessity will be served by the construction and operation of Heskett 4, that Montana Dakota is fit, willing, and able to provide such service, and that Heskett 4 is a prudent and reasonable resource for North Dakota electric customers. Now, in addition to those two cases, pending before the Commission is case 19-317, which is Montana Dakota's application seeking an order from the Commission for deferred accounting costs related to the retirement of three coal-fired generating stations, those being Lewis and Clark 1, Heskett 1, and Heskett 2, until the time of Montana Dakota's next general electric rate case. Montana Dakota is subject to GAAP accounting rules, which require it to accelerate depreciation in order to fully depreciate assets to their expected retirement date for financial reporting purposes. Montana Dakota requests an order authorizing deferred accounting for the retirement-related expenses of these three generating stations until the disposition of its next electric rate case. Now, just a month ago, on March 30th, 2020, Montana Dakota and advocacy staff reached a settlement agreement resolving all issues in the three cases pending before the commission. Pursuant to the terms of the joint settlement agreement, Montana Dakota and advocacy staff both agree the commission should grant the ADP and CDP or CPCN for Heskett 4 as reasonable and prudent resource. Both parties also agree that Montana Dakota has met the standard for deferred accounting treatment of the costs associated with the retirement of the three generation plants. So Montana Dakota respectfully requests the commission approve and adopt the terms of the joint settlement agreement in their entirety. So with those statements, Judge, we would be ready to call our first witness, Darcy Nigam.
Darcy Nigam, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Mr. Nigam, I'm required by law to tell you the penalties for perjury in this state. Perjury is a Class C felony punishable by a fine of up to $10,000 or a term of imprisonment of up to 5 years or both. Do you understand what perjury is and the penalties for it?
Yes, I do.
Understanding so, do you promise or swear that the testimony that you're about to give will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
Yes.
Mr. Sanderson, you may begin.
Thank you. Mr. Nigam, could you please state your full name and business address for the record?
Darcy Nigam, Montana Dakota Utilities, 400 North 4th Street, Bismarck, North Dakota, 58501.
And Mr. Nigam, what is your position with MDU?
I am the Director of Electric System Operations and Planning.
Could you briefly describe your educational background for the commission?
Yes. I have a Bachelor's of Science degree in Electrical Engineering from North Dakota State University and also a Master's of Business Administration from the University of Mary.
And could you describe your work experience with MDU?
I've worked for MDU for 24 years. The last 11 years have been in my current role as Director of Electric System Operations and Planning. A part of that role in Electric System Operations and Planning is the development of our integrated resource planning activity.
And Mr. Nigam, are you familiar with MDU's applications for the Advanced Determination of Prudence and Certificate of Public Convenience and Necessity for the Heskett 4 88 megawatt simple cycle combustion turbine?
Yes, I am.
And describe your involvement with this project.
I was involved in the development of our 2019 integrated resource plan, which would show the need and for the addition of the Heskett 4 resource, as well as the retirement of the Lewis and Clark number one, Heskett number one, and Heskett number two generation resources. And I also filed testimony in this case.
And you indicated you pre-filed written testimony in this case. If you were asked those same questions as in your pre-filed testimony, would your answers today be the same?
Yes, they would.
Okay. Can you, Mr. Nigam, can you please provide the commission with a general overview of the Heskett 4 project?
The Heskett 4 project is a simple cycle natural gas fired combustion turbine. It will be a GE frame unit, similar to the unit that's at Heskett 3. It will be located immediately adjacent to the Heskett 3 unit. It will also utilize the existing pipeline that Montana Dakota Utilities built for the Heskett 3 resource, which taps in at the Northern Border Pipeline, 24 miles south of the facility. That plant also will interconnect into Montana Dakota Utilities' Heskett 115 substation. That process will use what's considered a generator replacement interconnection agreement with MISO, the Mid-Continent Independent System Operator. MDU has filed for that replacement generator interconnection. The studies are complete and it has been signed. So in that, MDU will be able to use the interconnection rights for Heskett 1 and Heskett 2 for the Heskett 4 resource and we will not have to go through the normal MISO generator interconnection queue process for that facility.
And Mr. Nigam, can you briefly explain the need and justification for the Heskett 4 project?
Yes. So the need for the Heskett 4 project is part of our 2019 Integrated Resource Plan and the analysis we did. So for the fourth Integrated Resource Plan dating back to 2013, we've looked at potential retirements and timing for the Heskett 1, 2, and also the Lewis and Clark resource. Part of that process, when we developed the previous Integrated Resource Plan, you know, we had identified through our modeling and at least through selections, you know, a future timing date to retire Heskett 1 and 2 plus Lewis and Clark. And in 2017, we were looking at replacing those units what would be a combined cycle resource. So part of our process when we looked at developing our 2019 Integrated Resource Plan, we wanted to focus more in on what was the actual timing for replacement of those units' retirements and what would be a replacement unit. So as part of that process, we initially looked at a time frame that would have been similar to the 2017 Integrated Resource Plan of retiring those three units closer to 2024. We went out for a request for proposal to support our decision and analysis for the timing of the retirement. And in that, we went through and did an analysis to look at what was the least cost options. As a part of that process, we no longer saw that the replacement of a future replacement of Heskett 1, 2, and Lewis and Clark would be with a combined cycle unit, but our model was indicating the use of a peaking combustion turbine. So we started digging into a little bit more in our modeling to determine the appropriate timing when that retirement could occur. So some of the analysis we did was actually looked at different retirement dates, whether it was in 2029, 2025, or 2021, as far as the retirement of those three units. And as we kept changing those dates and getting closer to a more recent date, which would be 2021, we ended up showing greater customer savings, at least through our integrated resource planning model, in a sooner retirement for those three units. We were also, as a part of our integrated resource plan, were able to confirm those results from our model, just looking at what current trends have been for natural gas prices, MISO energy prices, and also looking at how those units had been dispatched and also changes in their O&M and fuel costs. We also took a look in our analysis of allowing our model to pick back any of those resources once we assumed a 2021 retirement date for them. The model had a choice to select back any of those three units for an additional 5-year period at no additional capital cost, so it would be at the existing O&M and fuel cost. Also, we ended up taking a look through a revenue requirement model to end up seeing what would be the customer impact that Mr. Jacobson will talk about after I'm done. It was showing what the potential impact and savings to customers would be associated with the retirements of the units. So in that analysis that we conducted, we ended up seeing that it was economical because the Heskett 1, 2, and Lewis and Clark units are no longer economic in the market to retire those units at the end of their current coal supply agreements. The anticipated retirement dates for those units will end up being approximately the end of March of 2021 for Lewis and Clark and the end of March of 2022 for the Heskett 1 and 2 resources. In that, when we look at our modeling, the least cost option that is selected as far as to replace those three units is the construction of the Heskett 4 simple cycle combustion turbine coupled with additional market purchases.
Can you explain the construction timeline and schedule for the Heskett 4 project?
Yes, the Heskett 4 project is currently expected to be completed online the spring of 2023. Since the timing that we filed our integrated resource plan in July of last year, some of the activities we've been working on, one is the generator replacement interconnection process, which I mentioned we've received. Also looking through the regulatory approvals for the Certificate of Public Convenience and Necessity and the Advanced Determination of Prudency, and also preparations that we've been making for the air permit for Heskett 4, which is expected to be filed soon. So that will take care of most of the activities up till the beginning of next year, at which point we will get into a more detailed engineering and procurement for the equipment needed for Heskett 4. And then the spring of 2022, we would look at starting construction, which should take the remainder of the year. And the unit will be ready and online shortly after the first of the year.
And Mr. Nigam, do you believe Montana Dakota's construction and operation of Heskett 4 is a reasonable and prudent electric resource addition?
Yes, I do.
Now, you're aware on March 30th, 2020, Montana Dakota and advocacy staff entered into a settlement agreement. Does Montana Dakota request the commission approve the terms of the joint settlement agreement that was entered into?
Yes, we do.
Your Honor, at this time, I have no further questions of this witness. Thank you.
Mr. Armstrong, do you have any questions for this witness?
No questions, Your Honor.
Does Mr. Hsu or Mr. Lean have any questions?
Yes, Your Honor. Mr. Nigam, so this current resource addition is heavily predicated on the most recent integrated resource plan, which you cited. With the recent changes that we've seen, not only in, of course, from the current pandemic, as well as the oil prices, how applicable is that resource plan now as it was previously?
It would still be valid.
So they're not seeing any load changes? Could there be a, instead of a load growth, a no load growth, or so forth?
So we have seen a slight drop in our customer load, just as there's more of the shelter in places and less business activity, but it has not been appreciable. The other thing we get into, if we talk about the amount of generation that is associated with Lewis and Clark, Heskett 1 and 2 is approximately 130, 140 megawatts. So in the retirement of that, we're replacing it actually with what ends up being a smaller unit.
Okay. Granted, a number of these questions, they're probably more oriented towards the integrated resource plan, but we didn't do an evaluation with that. Could you describe with this evaluation, did you look for any scenarios where you possibly, or changes that you could have made so that the plant didn't have to run as a must run, or possibly run only seasonally to maybe coincide with better market prices? Are those all things that the company evaluated?
So there are things that we did consider. One of the challenges for those units, both Heskett units and Lewis and Clark, is they do have dedicated mines that we have. So we still have the obligations, at least for the fixed cost of the mines on the fuel, are things we can't forego. And at least our current agreements, at least for Heskett, do have minimum take requirements that we end up having. You know, one of the other challenges for those units, even if you make them economic dispatch or seasonally dispatched, is you still have to incur the operations and maintenance costs associated with them, you know, which was part of our analysis when we looked at the revenue requirements associated with those and the replacement. Those are still significant costs that we would have to continue to incur.
Sure. One thing that came up in the application, as well as some of the testimony, was that you guys were expecting a reduction in costs due to emission reductions with the air permitting process. It was only briefly touched on. It was only even given an explanation of how that works and what type of savings you think the company would be realizing from that.
So the savings are associated similar to what we have for the generator interconnection. You know, that we have an ability to use the existing interconnection rights without having to pay for additional upgrades. You know, on the air side, we'll take a look as far as what would be a netting arrangement, you know, that we currently have for what our emission limits are and what we do have for, our emission, you know, the tonnages that we have. We have an ability to use those in a similar netting sort of piece, you know, as far as with the new plant. So the largest cost savings we end up seeing is at least for the Heskett 4 resource, similar to Heskett 3. We can use a dry low NOx combustion technology and not have to put a selective catalytic reduction or SCR unit on the back of Heskett 4, which has it's a multi-million dollar savings that it ends up having.
Okay. Those are all the questions I had. Thank you.
Commissioner Crotchus.
Good afternoon, Darcy. A little different format this time around, but thank you for bearing with us in order to get through the hearing. Can you just reiterate a few things for me? One would be, that there will be no future infrastructure needed on either the transmission or natural gas pipeline side. Is that correct?
That is correct. So we have signed the replacement generator interconnection agreement for Heskett 4 in that there are no network upgrade costs that are required. You know, there certainly are costs associated with getting the energy from the terminals of the generator, you know, to the point of interconnection in the Heskett substation. You know, as it pertains to the gas supply, the 24-mile pipeline that we constructed to Northern Border was sized for both units when we originally constructed that. So all we're really looking for is an additional takeoff from that existing pipe over to the Heskett 4 resource.
Okay, so in other words, no surprises 5-10 years down the road in terms of anything that would reasonably be recognized at this point in time?
That's correct.
You had indicated that energy usage is down. Just out of curiosity, is energy usage down on the residential side, or is it just down on the commercial side?
So part of that we've seen, at least year to date, you know, that we're down across, you know, all classes of customers. You know, some of that can also be attributed to at least what weather is as well. You know, so, you know, part of that, you know, certainly does pertain to the shelter in place. The other one, you know, has pertained to at least, you know, weather that we end up seeing at least this winter, you know, kind of caused us to get off on sales being down to start with as far as year to date.
And I realize it's not directly applicable to this particular hearing, but it would seem if people are spending more time at home, I just would have expected that residential use might have actually ticked up a little bit more just because people are in their homes only or more often.
I think that's probably true as well. Some of that we just haven't seen enough detail from the billing cycle that comes in on those customers in those classes. So, you know, even though we talk about we've seen, you know, where we are year to date, you know, we haven't seen what really has been the last billing month yet from those impacts. So there tends to be a lag between usage and as far as timing of billing.
Let's switch gears a little bit. As more coal units are retired, there are a number of market purchase estimates that go into this analysis. But as more coal plants are retired, how confident are you in the market purchase estimates that were cited in various places in this particular application?
As far as it pertains to the retirement of the Heskett, you know, 1 and 2 and Lewis and Clark units, I'm highly confident in our analysis. You know, some of those units today are not, they're not competitive in the market. They're not economic. And in some cases, when we talk about Heskett 1 and 2, they're significantly out of the market at times. So, you know, the turnaround that market prices would have to see and change would have to be, you know, significant. And that's just one of the things we don't forecast and see. You know, the other ones we end up having as well is Montana Dakota Utilities, you know, being at the edge of MISO and just a lot of the additional renewable generation that's being added for others, you know, kind of around us. Even though we don't own, have contracts for that, that still ends up being additional energy at the end of a system, at least that our units would have to compete with. So we'll end up seeing the benefits our customers will in market purchase prices just because there's such a high amount of generation that others are building, siting in our area. You know, it competes with our generation today, and it's also shipped to the same places that the load is to the east of us.
You know, go ahead.
I would say some of the sensitivities we did were also, you know, related to around trying to find some of those outliers where it would have made sense to continue to run, you know, Heskett 1, 2, and Lewis and Clark. So we did some joint sensitivities where we increased natural gas prices, you know, $5 a decatherm over the current forecast of $3. So we're talking $8 gas, and we're adding $25 on top of market energy purchase prices, which would go from $25 to $50. You know, in doing that, those units still were not selected to continue to run.
Okay, so at $8 gas, it still makes sense. What's the breaking point on the price of gas? Do you know?
So part of that is when we construct Heskett 4, it's a peaking unit. You know, it's needed for our capacity need that we have for our load growth, particularly driven by the retirements of Heskett 1, 2, and Lewis and Clark. You know, and just because those units are not dispatching, you could probably almost get to an infinite gas cost, you know, before there, and still not see an impact, at least to what our customer electric rates would end up being, because the units wouldn't dispatch. And so the real driver is to go off to the MISO market and say, what happens on that side? So at this point, you know, we're off to doubling it. And at that point, we still haven't seen a place where it's, you know, still telling us to continue to run these units, which tells us just how uneconomic they are.
Good. I think I have one more question for you, and that would be it. I just had it on the tip of my tongue, and I was taking a few notes, and I missed it. I may have to circle back to you on redirect. Okay. So no other questions at this time. Thank you, Darcy.
Yep. You're welcome, Commissioner Crushes.
Commissioner Christman, any questions for this witness? Commissioner Christman.
Yes, sir. When you just mentioned the high operating costs, that would suggest that your plan is good almost to infinite gas prices. Why are the operating costs so much? And before you answer that, let me ask you a different question first. I didn't get the witness list of all the different things, what item on the witness list they are. On the exhibit list, I mean, but I believe Mr. Heidel's testimony was one of them. Do you have that with you?
I do.
Okay, so on page 19 of Mr. Heidel's testimony, he says that these three coal plants, the operating costs are the highest in their peer group. Do you agree with that? And if so, why are they so high?
I do agree with that. You know, one of the reasons they're so high in their peer group is, you know, based upon their age and size, they are relative to the rest of the facilities, you know, similar to this. You know, these units are some of the smallest coal plants. You know, they are in the state of North Dakota, and at least they would be in the MISO footprint. You know, so we're talking about resources in Heskett 1 that's 20 megawatts. We end up looking at Lewis and Clark is 43 and Heskett 2 is 70. Because of their small size, they don't have the economies of scale, you know, as far as efficiencies and the number of operators to run the plant, and they don't also have the efficiencies that it would be as far as their heat rate and efficiency to convert coal into electricity.
So when he talks about a peer group, is he would their peer group be plants like the Coyote Station and AVS and Coal Creek, or I assume their peer group was plants similar in size to these three?
Yeah, I guess I'm not sure when he's referring to peer group. I would have just lumped it with all coal, because that's what it's competing with in the market.
Well, that would make it more understandable. So in your modeling, you had a high end for gas prices through the entirety of this decade, not going above $6, correct?
Correct.
What's been the high end of gas prices in your career with MDU?
North of 14 for short periods of time.
So with a lot of shale oil wells being shut in, do you have any reconsideration of leaving the high end as low as $6, that a lot of the gas that we use comes from shale oil wells and may not be available long term?
So part of that, when we talk about gas, and I guess, you know, I was looking at the sensitivities as well. You know, I think it's the base case as far as gas forecasts were showing that's going from this $3 to $6. You know, we did sensitivities where we added an additional $2 and $5 on top of that. You know, so we would be above, you know, that $6 range that you're referring to. You know, the other ones, if we're talking about these resources, you know, and as far as being a peaking turbine, they're not expected to run. So even in the periods of time when gas prices, you know, could become high or volatile, you know, we're not looking at a place of needing to run those units, you know, and would still be largely more dependent upon, you know, what's the broader energy market, you know, price for energy, or the ability to, if we haven't fully dispatched, you know, our other resources, to be able to accommodate for any sort of load our customer may need.
Okay. And then I want to go back to Mr. Heidel's testimony again, this time to page 20. And but you talked a few moments ago in your direct testimony, and then in response to Commissioner Karasius's questions, about the modeling that you've done. He says here that the most runs of the modeling show the same system expansion solutions, adding Heskett 4 that we're talking about, plus 54 megawatts of wind, plus and 10 megawatts of purchase power in 2022, adding 100 megawatts of solar in 2025, and 110 megawatts of combined cycle natural gas in 2025. Is that consistent with what your modeling indicates, in your opinion?
Yes, it is.
So this says adding the Heskett 4 in 2022, and we're hearing today of it being added in 2023. Explain that difference to me.
So some of that is, you know, just related to the timing that it takes to actually, you know, one, get through the existing coal contract that we have. You know, when we did the retirement analysis, you know, we wanted to retire all three of the units, at least at the same time. So that way, from an efficiency side, the model could come up with what's the best long-term resource, you know, where in actuality, we ended up knowing that, you know, the units were going to be staggered, and largely because the coal supply agreement at Heskett Station, you know, runs a year longer than the current one does at Lewis and Clark. And so when we talk about the Heskett resources, you know, that coal contract ends the end of 2022. And so we're looking to just extend that, you know, a couple months, just so we're not having to do a shutdown and decommissioning activities starting in the winter season.
I'm starting to become confused on what the end date specifically, or especially with Heskett, is.
So the specific end date.
Heskett 1 and 2 I'm talking about. I'm understanding it that is anticipated to come offline in the spring of 2022.
That is correct.
And Heskett 4 will come online in the spring of 2023, a year later.
That is right.
But in this modeling that Mr. Heidel lays out on page 20, he talks about the need for Heskett 4 in 2022. So why push it back to 2023?
So 2023 is really driven by the construction cycle, you know, that it takes from when we identified the construction of Heskett 4, you know, looking at getting our approvals, our interconnections permits, to do our procurements, engineering, and construction, you know, unless we would have gone to an expedited sort of schedule and threw more dollars at this, you know, that was the time frame that we were looking for, is to have the unit completed, you know, the beginning of 2023. And so that does leave us a place as far as the model itself, you know, has to have sufficient resources in order for it to solve. And so in that, you know, when we looked at the retirement dates, which was the end of 2021, it would say pick something else in 2022. And in that is where it was selecting the Heskett 4 resource. You know, we can't meet that date from a construction standpoint. So we will go off and we will buy capacity through a bilateral agreement from one of our neighbors, at least to bridge that gap that we have.
Refresh me I've driven by so many times, visited the Heskett site either right after opening of Heskett 3 or maybe shortly before it even started operations. I don't recall. Am I remembering correctly, the 1 and 2 are almost on the banks of the river, and then Heskett 3 is right adjacent to them, just to the west of 1 and 2. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And Heskett 4 will be just to the west of Heskett 3, correct?
Yes.
When it comes to the ADP, I just got to tell you, so you can respond to this. This is my biggest hang up with this, that we're being told that for basically a full calendar year, through a summer heat cycle, through a winter cold cycle, from spring of 2022 until spring of 2023, we can do without Heskett 4 for both capacity and energy through the markets. Then we start this in 2023, and by 2025, you're anticipating bringing on 110 megawatts of combined cycle, which presumably, as long as it's being built, probably wouldn't have a lot of price change to be just a little more than that even. So it just seems to me, if we can get by for a whole calendar year without this plant, we could get by for 2.5 years and just wait and do the combined cycle.
So the one piece on the combined cycle, you know, that was a proposal that came out of the RFP that we had for the 2019 Integrated Resource Plan. So it's not the construction of a combined cycle from Montana Dakota Utilities. So in that, we haven't contracted, and to my knowledge, that facility is not available to us anymore. You know, we left that in the model, even though it was something we were not looking at building, or as far as having an ownership piece too, but it's giving us guidance, you know, for what we should be looking at as far as for a next resource. And so the other one, when we take a look at, you know, the time period between, you know, the closure of Heskett 1 and 2 and the construction of Heskett 4, you know, there ends up being a risk to the local reliability, you know, that we could say that we would end up having. But in that, you know, I think it overcomes or is very manageable by looking at what's the economic benefit, you know, at least to the customers, you know, in the closure, you know, sooner of the Heskett 1 and 2 resources, just because of the potential savings and also because of the amount of capacity and energy that's currently available on the system. One of the challenges for us, and it provides an economic savings, as I mentioned, is the generator replacement, the MISO generator replacement process. You know, and in that, you're limited to a 3-year time window as far as when you shut down an existing resource. You have 3 years until its replacement resource comes online. Otherwise, you lose those interconnection rights. So we can't sit and wait, you know, out until 2025 if we're closing, you know, the Heskett, you know, 1 and 2, at least at an earlier date. In order to do that, we have to continue to run those units to be able to push that replacement date off farther and farther.
What about the 54 megawatts of wind that's mentioned in the modeling runs here to be added in 2022 already?
So the 54 megawatts of wind and solar, you know, both of those that the model picks, those were options that were given to us in the RFP that we had for the 2019 IRP. So in that, one of the biggest concerns for a lot of those generators that we saw in that RFP was that they didn't have final network interconnection costs. And so in that, they were highly speculative. And one of the conditions of all of those resources is they would want to adjust their price or cancel the agreement, depending what they ultimately would find out for needed upgrades once they went through the MISO process. So we have not contracted for those. And also those would not be still applicable to us, you know, as far as time frame for our next resource plan. And so we left those in to, again, not to bias our modeling to show is, you know, we can't potentially buy something from someone else. So then it isn't just showing a bunch of, you know, self-built items that, that Montana, Dakota had included as supply side resources.
I just want to go back to the combined cycle that, that the modeling suggests here. If that does come to fruition in 2025, Heskett 4 will not be particularly useful anymore, will it?
So part of the driver, again, in looking at, you know, this 110 megawatt combined cycle, and again, that's a part of a larger project. So, you know, is what our future need still continues to be for capacity going forward? You know, because we still look at having a customer load growth that's still, you know, 1.5% potentially over the next 5 years, you know, there still ends up being future resources of how we meet that capacity need that we do have. And so it isn't that it would replace, the combined cycle wouldn't replace Heskett 4, would be something additional that we would need to meet our additional capacity and energy requirements for our customers.
But it seems to me if we end up needing to add that capacity, we've got a $70 million capacity peaking plant here that will seldom need to be used and was really set up for 2 years as a bridge.
So one of the pieces we've left as well, you know, when we've laid out construction of Heskett 3 and 4 is at least that potential to combine cycle those still in the future. You know, when we've looked at our own self-build combined cycle unit, it was using those resources over at Heskett for that purpose. You know, the economics are not there at this point just because of the lower gas prices and where we end up with lower energy prices, you know, and also what the capital cost for that would be to have moved forward with that. And that's one of the reasons we had our change of course from our previous resource plans, which were identifying combined cycle at Heskett, caused us to move away because, you know, we take a look at if gas prices are low and abundant and if energy prices, you know, are low in the MISO market, there isn't the need, the benefit to build combined cycle at this time.
Okay, and then help me get past this point, because kind of what I'm hearing is the parts of the modeling that suggest moving forward with the plan, I'm hearing you say are pretty much all still in order. And the parts of the modeling that to me really draw red flags, I'm hearing, well, but that was modeling before and things have changed. And so it seems to me either the modeling should be accurate and up to date, or it's not accurate and it's not up to date. And I'm hearing a mixture of the two.
So we end up having at least modeling as of where we're at in the short term, and then also modeling at where we're in the long term. You know, one of the things that gave us great comfort in making this decision was that customer impact revenue requirement modeling we did as well. Because a lot of that would look at what's the impact to the customers and rates. You know, are they going to see rates go up, or are they going to see rates that end up going down because of that? And that was the additional analysis piece that we did, you know, of looking at, you know, what's the change, you know, that customers are going to see in their bills, of which there was a significant savings associated with this plan.
No other questions. Thank you, Larissa.
Thank you, Commissioner Christen.
Commissioner Fedorchuk.
Hi, Darcy.
Good afternoon, Commissioner Fedorchuk.
Okay. Let's see. I've got a number of questions. I'm trying to decide where to start. So the after the retirement of the coal units, well, okay, let's start with those units. In the materials from the our staff and advocacy, I think it mentions, or maybe it was in your testimony, I can't recall, that the units have been running at their minimum output at 80 to 90% of the time?
That is correct.
What is that minimum? What is their minimum level output? What percentage of their capacity?
It will depend on the unit, just based on their technology and also their permit limits. So from Heskett 1, you know, which has about a net maximum output of 20 megawatts, it can run down as low as 7. where we end up seeing for Heskett 2, which is a 70 megawatts it can dispatch into the market, you know, we tend up seeing that one running probably closer to 53 for a minimum that it has. And when we look at the Lewis and Clark unit, which would normally be 43 megawatts that it can put into the market, it generally can run somewhere around 35 megawatts for a minimum load.
Okay. And were those plants at the minimum load most often still losing money because the market price was lower than their cost?
They would be more expensive than the market, which is why they were running at minimum.
Oh, sure. All right. Back, what year were the last environmental upgrades made on those facilities?
The last largest, so Heskett 2, at least for part of its regional haze, did add a conversion to add sand to the fluidized bed, which I think was in 2018. The last major upgrade for Lewis and Clark dealt with the mercury and air toxic standard rule, which those upgrades were completed the end of 2015.
And what was the deadline for them if you hadn't done those? I mean, by making those upgrades, you intended to run them for significantly longer than you are proposing now. Am I right?
So the upgrades were one would end up being required for the units to continue to operate. You know, in the case of Lewis and Clark, we would have had to shut those units down even earlier than that. You know, in the case of Heskett, two, and I think I said sand, it was a limestone addition that we did for SO2 removal. I think we also would have probably have had to shut those units down at an earlier date as well.
Okay. Would they be facing additional requirements for haze if you were to keep them open longer? I mean, is the state in its evaluation of the next round of the haze, have they assumed they're retiring and taken them out?
So where it stands because of our announcement, you know, that the state of North Dakota was not including them for regional haze, you know, in this next round. Otherwise, you know, there is, I'm not sure on the applicability if Heskett 2 would have been subject to that. Montana is the same way. They would have looked at that unit for regional haze, but because of the retirement that's out there, even though we gave them a four-factor analysis, there is no additional work that's being done to determine what would be required.
If you hadn't been retiring, do you think you would have been adding more costs to make them compliant?
There is the potential for that, yes.
But the investments that you did make were needed to keep them running this long. It isn't investments that were kind of above and beyond and would have cleared them for another 10 years.
So they were the requirements that we had to keep the facilities running. You know, the most major one ends up being the ones at Lewis and Clark. In that, if we would not have made those upgrades, we would have had to shut those units down the spring of 2015. You know, when we looked at installing, you know, the mercury and air toxic standard, those upgrades, you know, we had talked about putting a bag house on that unit. I think we had an ADP for that. We went through and saw those costs were much more and significantly higher than we expected. So we found some other alternatives, you know, to do some enhancements to the wet scrubber, put some additional mist eliminators trays in the stack to be able to meet the permit levels. So we found an economic way to do that. Also, the analysis that we conducted at that time when we made those investments, you know, talked about, you know, the need to run the plant for only an additional 5-year time period to be able to recover that capital cost, made it economic. In that, okay. As soon as we got into those upgrades, all of a sudden, you know, there's another set of rules that came around as it dealt with the coal combustion residual rule, and as far as some additional work that needed to be done as far as some more ash ponds. And so in that, whether it's the MATS rules, you know, the coal combustion residual rules, regional haze, there's always some additional challenge that's coming with those units to add potentially more cost in the future.
Yeah. So you mentioned that your analysis of the upgrades showed that you needed to run them for 5 years for customers to get their investment back. Is that, then we can be assured that when customers say to us, we just spent a bunch of money making these units environmentally compliant, and now you're allowing the company to shut them down. We haven't even paid for all that yet. What do we say to people who make those claims?
So one of those investments were prudent when we made them, and they were needed to keep the plants running. You know, even in the case of Lewis and Clark, you know, that unit is on the edge of the Bakken. And if we go back to the time frame of 2015, you know, we had all of this rapid growth that was going on out there. You know, there wasn't enough transmission into the area. Our neighbors were building lots of gas turbines overnight just to try to meet the demand that was out there. And so if we wouldn't have made those investments in 2015, that it would have been, we would have been having to find somewhere very quickly to end up replacing that generation that was needed on a baseload basis, you know, to be able to meet what was going on out there, you know, which supported, you know, customers, you know, in Montana and in North Dakota, Lewis Clark does. The other thing, we take a look at what's the impact in doing that. And I think that's what Travis can talk about, you know, as well, is, you know, the economic analysis we had on the revenue requirement, you know, takes into account, you know, those remaining net book values and future depreciation of them, you know, and including the, you know, investment in Heskett 4, and there is still a significant savings, you know, that even the commissioner's you know, consultant on this, Mr. Jim Heidel, also did confirm, you know, that was, you know, real and accurate.
All right. You mentioned the Bakken. So this retirement doesn't replace a unit out in kind of the west. Doesn't provide a baseload unit right out there in the heart of the Bakken, where I know that has been in the past concerns that there isn't enough, you know, dispatchable baseload right there to support that heavy load. Have you looked at that? Do you guys have a concern about that?
So we do not. And some of that is the difference between what our load growth is, and at least participating in MISO, versus what, you know, Basin and their members have for their position in Southwest Power Pool. You know, the big concern we had back in that 2015 time period, 14-15, you know, what was the lack of transmission, you know, and at least of what was being considered under WAPA's tariff was, you know, less than firm sorts of transmission rights they were giving, and having the need to have very local generation that, you know, had to meet the loads that are out there. Those pieces we've seen have gone away, and we're on an equal footing that we end up having, you know, as far as with Basin and their members to serve load out there, which the majority of the load growth is theirs. And so, you know, we still have the Rice units are out at Lewis and Clark. You know, one of the big benefits that they provide and that the Lewis and Clark coal plants provide is voltage support in that area. So not so much the megawatts, but what do they do for voltage? And those units are still available to provide that service. You know, we've taken a look as well and ended up saying, you know, was that a location for another generator replacement project? And we just haven't found anything that makes economic sense to use those interconnection rights out there, just because the potential number of megawatts, you know, to install is certainly smaller than what it is at Heskett.
Okay. Did you do any discussions with Basin on a potential joint project out there?
So we've had conversations with them in the past, you know, on opportunities. You know, a lot of the locations they would site stuff didn't have transmission that was, you know, available for us, you know, just because it was connecting on some of their members' transmission. But we haven't found anything, you know, with them that makes, you know, economic and timing sense as far as for both of us. But it's something that we're still interested, you know, to have conversations, you know, potentially for the future.
And how long would you be able to still use your interconnection at the Lewis and Clark site? I mean, I know it's only, 44 megawatts, but.
It'd be 44. So that would just be 3 years. So it would be the spring of 2024, something would have to come online.
Mm-hmm.
The other one that has to happen to be able to do that is you do have to provide, you know, notice 6 months prior to shutting the resource down that you're planning to do that. So it, one of the ways in those replacements, you don't have an ability to hold those rights, you know, for 3 years and decide something to do. You have to make that, you know, decision known before you actually shut the resource down. At least identify what it is and have it the study started.
Yeah. And you haven't done any work with Basin on that, saying we've got this interconnect here and it's in a pretty key spot. You guys have need long term. Should we be working together on something?
So we did have a conversation with them around that. You know, some of that when you look at having only, 43 megawatts, we would end up having, something only like a single LM6000 that could be, placed there, similar to something that Basin has been building. So you certainly would not have the economies of scale, and the other ones that you would have if you would go towards that type of resource or reciprocating, is one, I think just the cost to construct anything out there and just in the smallness of it, just the challenges it'll have of not having efficiencies.
Sure. Okay. Let's see. Kind of following up on Randy's question about the economics of these units. In, I think it was Heidel's comments, he actually said that the unit costs are higher than comparable units, similar units in size and age. So yours, these, and it was, I think, page 18 of his testimony, the peer group he looked at. I chose a peer group of coal plants operating in the MISO market with similar age and size characteristics. I found the three coal plants' historical operating costs were the highest of their peer group. So it actually, to me, sounds like he picked units that were similar in size, and these were the highest cost.
I'm looking at that now. Yes, I do see that. That he did expand on what the peer group was.
Do you have any other ideas besides what you told Randy, that you thought that it was economies of scale that would lead you to explain why these units were so costly?
So in the standpoint of Lewis and Clark, certainly, one of the impacts we end up having and did, is just with, being able to retain employees. And a lot of that was the ramp up in the Bakken, so a lot of our pay practices that we did have historically, were much higher than what others would have just because of the location of where they're operated.
Okay. But that's just Lewis and Clark, not Heskett necessarily.
Correct. And so, I don't know that I would have, a good thought as far as on Heskett, what end up may being the difference, other than the fact that there certainly probably aren't a whole lot of small units. And a lot of times people who have small units, they're co-located with many of them on a single site. And so even though you may only have, some of those economies of scale, we don't end up having, that ability to spread it across, a lot of different units. One of the things we also did in our analysis, and some of that is looking at, the revenue requirements for the units, we did also take a look, what would we have to reduce, O&M and at least the fuel cost at, these units to make them competitive. And some of those, at least in the case of where we were at for Heskett, we're basically saying based on the current fuel cost, we'd have to drive those O&M down to zero. And I think at Lewis and Clark, we'd have to drive them down, cut them by 50%, as well as a corresponding reduction of fuel cost by 50%. That we're just talking that they're just so far out of the market, for what else we could be purchasing, those needs from.
Right. Okay. The resource is largely needed for capacity, is that correct?
So we have a capacity and an energy need, certainly with the retirement, you know, of those three plants. You know, the main benefit, you know, we receive for Heskett 4 is the low cost, long-term capacity addition. You know, and at this point, you know, coupling that with energy market purchases, you know, is the least cost option for us.
Mm-hmm. You expect, did I understand it correctly that the, if you anticipate this running like 1 or 2% of the time is all?
So at least from the modeling side, when we take a look at, you know, energy prices, and one of the things when we have our energy prices, you know, we're using averages, you know, across all hours. So we don't really see, you know, the peaks and the valleys that sometimes happens in energy prices. So just based upon, you know, availability of the market and at least of historically what we've seen these units operate at, we currently have, those seem like good assumptions or at least outputs from the model to say, you know, those 1% sort of, you know, capacity factors, you know, reflect what we currently see with our other gas turbines today.
Okay. Then I need to just go back to the line of questioning that Randy was asking about why it makes sense to build this unit now when you've got, when it's going to run so little, you could buy the capacity in the market and wait until you have a bigger, maybe more, a larger economy of scale need in a couple of years. I didn't fully understand your explanation to Randy on that.
Okay. So one of the things we end up with in the construction of Heskett 4, you know, it does provide local reliability benefits. You know, so when we talk about the risks, you know, today we end up with three generators that are located over at Heskett. You know, those resources are directly connected into the Bismarck-Mandan area, and they provide reliability benefits to us. You know, if we just try to bridge for a longer period of time, you know, that we're carrying that risk, you know, with us as far as if there's an issue as far as delivery into Bismarck-Mandan, we're limited as far as how much generation is within this pocket. You know, which is one of the things, you know, we've tried to minimize some of that, you know, by trying to limit that gap as much as we can, though there is a gap of a year. You know, the other one, we see tremendous value when we look at the MISO generator interconnection queue today. And I would say SPP is the same way, how it's challenging to get generation through that queue and at least the potential cost that you get hit for network upgrades. And so where we end up having is, you know, being able to use that generator replacement process that MISO had, we basically were able to skip that whole generator queue process. You know, we know what the interconnection costs are and customers continue to use that value that's over at Heskett Station. And the same thing is true even on the emission side, you know, that we're able to, you know, utilize, you know, the air emissions that we have for the coal plants to allow for a lesser capital addition, you know, option over at Heskett. And so otherwise, if we take a look at the, you know, the difference in cost between, you know, building Heskett 4 and what would be a greenfield site or something, you know, it's significant savings to customers that they'll have over the long term.
That emission piece you just mentioned, I hadn't thought of this, but so you can, if you took a 2-year gap and didn't have anything, so you let go of the interconnect, you'd have to start all over with that. Would you have to apply for a new air permit and then be under some strict potential strict requirements there for a new gas fire facility versus just converting an old coal one to a gas, which is a better, quote unquote, better exchange when it comes to air and CO2, et cetera?
So at least on the air permit side, you know, the way that netting does look, it looks at what your average emission rates have been. I think it's over like the last 5 years, and that's sort of this target you're kind of staying, you know, within in your permit application. You know, otherwise you have to look at that you're this more of a new source, and what does a new source require? And so in that, if you're locating this gas turbine, you know, next to a coal plant that's been running baseload, you know, there's a much higher level of emissions, you know, that you can net against in its five-year history. You know, where if you turn around and you're saying I've got another gas turbine, or if I've got this coal plant that's dispatching economically on the seasons, you know, you would have less emissions netting capability, you know, to use in your permit siting. And so in that, you lose flexibility in the number of hours, or you end up having to install, you know, more capital technologies and O&M cost in order to be able to get as much value out of the unit as you can.
So how much of this strategy is using this unit as a placeholder for both the emissions and the interconnection?
I don't see it as a placeholder. I think it's a way there's tremendous value, you know, economically and long-term reliability for the company to be able to utilize. You know, one of the places, even if we talk about this other combined cycle, you know, that we had in the RFP, you know, that we haven't talked about location. The location for that was actually a site that was over in Wisconsin, you know, that was pitched to us. And so it wasn't even something that would be on our system or even in, you know, the next neighboring state. And so sometimes when we take a look at, you know, our resources that we have, you know, one is what's the best way we can make, you know, use and opportunities, you know, things on or near our system, just because the other reliability benefits they provide. But when we talk about, you know, the Heskett 4, you know, the value in the interconnection and in the air permits is substantial. One on certainty and of knowing what you're going to have, you know, for costs and timing, and you're not having to sit and wait. You know, I think some of the current MISO, you know, DPP process is almost taking 4 years to go through the generator interconnection process, just because the studies and queues are so backed up. And when they come out of that, they end up seeing that they've got network upgrades that are sometimes double the cost of the project.
Right. Yep. Okay. A couple other questions here. So going at this kind of a completely opposite from what my last point was, which is you could rely on market purchases. Do you, now I'm going to go the total opposite side of that and say, do you feel that MDU is vulnerable in relying as much on market purchases as you are with this plan to meet your obligation? And how are you comforted in knowing that other utilities in the market aren't relying on the same availability and there won't be enough? It's the, you know, capacity overall in MISO shrinking.
You know, it certainly is, you know, something we thought long and hard about. You know, when we end up looking at, you know, today, at least in North Dakota and around us, there's this, you know, overwhelming desire that people have to build more and more wind. You know, and that wind will be there for a long period of time. We're talking 20, 25 years. And when all of that wind wants to generate, especially if there's more and more of it, we end up seeing those are the periods of time, at least, that pricing will end up being the lowest. And so our customers will receive that benefit. You know, there's no way to all of a sudden bulk that up and load it on rail cars and ship it somewhere else. You know, we're going to see the long-term benefits, you know, of having that generation of others located near our customer loads. The other piece that's a part of that is if the wind doesn't blow or the sun doesn't shine, you know, you've got to have something that balances to that, you know, and if people aren't putting, you know, other steel in the ground, rotating shafts, that's the period of time that we're going to want to have price protection for our customers, you know, and also have some way to, you know, also maybe take benefits of market sales that we may end up seeing. And so, you know, we're kind of going about this, you know, we understand, you know, our area is flush with energy and it's just continuing to grow. We take a look at between, you know, our MISO line that goes from Heskett, you know, down to Wishick, Ellendale, and to Big Stone, you know, there's soon going to be, I think it's almost 900 megawatts of wind that is going to be on that line. None of that is ours, you know, and our peak load, you know, today is just a little over 600 is where we're at. And so I think we're really situated in a good place, you know, to one, rely on that market, you know, more than we have in the past, but also know that's something we need to watch, you know, and to be able to, you know, if we need to, it's one of the things in the gap that we have, you know, that Commissioner Christman brought up, was showing that we really don't have, you know, penciled in resources. You know, when we talk about some of this future wind, solar, you know, or combined cycle, you know, it still leaves us with some flexibility to see how this plays out over the next couple of years, and then not to jump into things with, you know, too much at one time.
Okay. The ART analyst found, and maybe this is for Travis, but probably not actually. ART analyst found savings that are half as much as what the company is proposing. I think that was in Mr. Heidel's testimony, page 23. Have you reviewed that, and what is your impression of their calculation of the savings?
So one of the things, and we talk, you know, about, you know, forecasts for MISO energy, you know, which is the part of the basis in his analysis, where do you get those future MISO costs? You know, he was using more of an indexed, you know, sort of price, you know, versus where we end up using our analysis is our historic values of what our MDU customer load has been. So we end up with two different pricing points that we're starting with, you know, in his analysis, because he wanted to make sure that I would say he wanted to fully show what the value, you know, might be for customers. You know, he was going, I think, on more of the higher range of a cost estimate for what those market purchases might be in the future. You know, so we're not estimating for the same one delivery point that MDU has, but also always taking the approach of saying, well, if it's $25, you know, today, we'll end up, you know, grabbing, you know, the higher cost MDU use, and we'll use $30, because that way we'll make sure that we're not cutting ourselves short. You know, I think the other one that he had in his amortization was also using a shorter time frame as well.
So basically, his calculation is pessimistic, and yours is the most optimistic, and we should probably, realistically, it'll be someplace in the middle.
So some of that we'll get into, you know, I think is if it's, it probably is a good word to say the most on the pessimistic side is where he was being. And so I would say, you know, it probably is something that may come in closer to ours, or maybe it is something that comes in the middle, you know, but there's other factors than just the energy price, because we still have, you know, some of the remaining, you know, depreciation, you know, of the remaining net book those units will have, and what do we have for periods that we're amortizing across?
Mm-hmm.
So there were some of the differences in the calculations too.
All right, two more questions. One of them is kind of just a real in the weeds, but why aren't more realistic decommissioning costs collected in rates? I mean, we've only collected a fraction of the decommissioning costs that are going to be needed for these plants. And I guess I've been under the impression all along that the company bakes those in from day one on new resources, so that there's a pot of money at the end and you don't have to go back and ask for a bunch more.
So I think some of that is, you know, Travis may be one that's better to address that. You know, because certainly I think those are one of those things in each of the rate cases that come up is how much of that funding do we want to do of those accounts? But I think Travis can give a better answer than I can.
All right. Then this last one I know is for you, Darcy, and it's kind of like a big philosophical question, but as I look at these applications, you're shutting down three long-time resources and building a new one. Those are pretty significant changes, wouldn't you say? Like, it's huge changes for the company?
Yes.
Did you guys entertain doing the full rate case rather than, this feels sort of piecemeal to me to do it with the way we're proposing here, without having a full discussion of the plan, the, you know, with this new IRP, the strategy long-term, how it, you know, factors into the current financial position of the company, and you know, rather than just looking at just these projects and saying, do these make sense based on these factors and nothing else is going on in the company?
So part of that, I think I would defer that to Travis as well. You know, I think he would be much more suited to answer that.
Okay. Travis, there's your cue. You can be prepared to give a good discussion on that one. That's it for me then, Darcy. Thank you.
You're welcome.
At this time, I think we'll take a break until 3:30 and come back and finish up with Mr. Nigam if there's any further questions. And so we're on break until 3:30. Well, we are back on the record, and it is about 3:30 p.m., and we are having a Mr. Nigam as the witness, and we're at the portion for redirect by Mr. Sanderson. Do you have any questions for Mr. Nigam?
Thank you, Judge. Miss Darcy, are you still on? Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Darcy, there were some questions asked, sort of, is the Heskett 4 being simply built at, or requested as a placeholder, or that it's not needed? Could you address those concerns?
Well, it is needed because of the need the company has for capacity. You know, and it also has gone through our resource plan that we have as being the best long-term, you know, least cost option to meet our customers' needs for capacity, you know, and also coupled with additional MISO energy purchases.
And it's still your belief that the Heskett 4 will provide reliable service and capacity for North Dakota customers?
Yes.
Okay. Mr. Nigam, I have no further questions. Thank you.
Recross, Mr. Armstrong.
No questions, Your Honor.
Mr. Hsu.
No questions.
Commissioners, Crotius.
Okay, Darcy, I did find a couple of the questions that I was searching for. One is related to peaking plants that run at approximately 10%, would that be a fair figure, or would you have a different number?
I'm sorry, can you repeat the question?
Peaking plants, are they normally running about 10% of the time?
I think that ends up depending where they're located. You know, I've heard some utilities in Minnesota, you know, that talk about peaking turbines running that much. You know, that has not been our experience, you know, out here in North Dakota and eastern Montana.
Okay. And some of the companies, and one was in Minnesota, where they estimated their peaking plant would run at 10% of the time, but they are actually running in the 20 to even pushing 30% range. Do you have any comments on that?
So one of the things, you know, that's different is you certainly have to look where the utility is located, you know, and so we end up having, I think, the, if not, you know, close to the lowest prices in MISO, you know, that we end up having. You know, the other ones, just because there's so much generation here and the congestion is to our east, you know, a lot of those times that those, you know, peaking turbines are running for others are around times of high you would have congestion on the transmission system, either other outages or ways that they're gearing overloads places. So they're having to redispatch generation around those overloads at congestion points. And so we don't have that on our system where we don't see that same volatility, you know, and our prices tend to be, you know, low and flat across all hours.
Okay, and then a little bit different question, the other one, and I think this will be it for me. The existing footprint adjacent to Heskett 3, that is where this unit will be placed, is that correct?
Correct.
So is it fair to say that this has been in planning for a number of years?
So when we built Heskett 3, you know, at least our modeling at that time, you know, that we had, we were still showing at least at an ultimate retirement date, you know, for the retirements of Heskett 1 and 2. This would go back to the 2013 IRPs when we started looking at retirement dates. You know, our model started to talk about, you know, combined cycle was what it was to have and replace that. We saw those same things in 2015 and in 2017. You know, and so in that, we always saw this as a potential place, you know, one, when we had the land, you know, when we built it, develop it, and the other one was just the cost of the pipeline to be able to have the ability to add a second, Heskett 4 unit, you know, next to Heskett 3. So it's something we've had available to us, and it's something that, has been, you know, something we've had in our toolbox for a while.
Right. And would it be fair to say, I think you did, but just to a number of the efficiencies for Heskett 4 from a cost standpoint are because of the existence of Heskett 3 and existing infrastructure. Would you agree with that?
Very much so.
Right. No other questions. Thank you.
Commissioner Christman.
What's like an upper limit of how much peaking plant of this model, this GE model, should run throughout the course of a year?
So part of that we'll go back to one is how you permit it and how you staff it. And so, you know, I think the upper end's probably on most people when they talk about what is peaking or tend to be, you know, up to those 30% sorts of runtime numbers, you know, that's been kind of mentioned at least just recently as far as, that you could target us as far as what's the upper limit most people see in peaking turbines.
Well, so when you sign natural gas contracts for this, what's the range of performance time that you use to calculate how much gas you need in order to acquire gas?
So one of the things that's been very efficient with Heskett 3, you know, is at least we've been able to go out and secure some very favorable gas supply contracts, you know, that do have some very flexible call provisions for them, you know, for next day and intraday dispatches, you know, to be able to not have to spend a lot of money on a firm, you know, reservation, but yet we have a firm-like product that's offered to us. You know, if we got into a situation where we had to run the unit more often, you know, we'd have to look and change of what our gas strategy was, you know, just to be able to, you know, make sure that it lines up with what our needs are.
How long are those gas contracts that you deal with there?
So that gas contract is fairly long term because we're basically getting real-time pricing, at least for the commodity that we end up having. So we're not talking about locking in a price for the next year. You know, we have that flexibility is basically being able to use whatever the current, you know, gas price is, which, you know, for us, that supply has been very, very low cost and stable based upon the runtime for the units.
So you have a contract that says it'll be based on some metric of gas prices, and that's what you will pay, right?
Well, we're getting a price quotation each day for the same day and the next day. And so if we have to run the units in those parameters, that's what we're going to be charged.
Okay. No other questions. Thank you.
Commissioner Fedorchuk.
I don't have any more questions. Thank you.
Okay. Are there any further questions by anyone else? Anyone I missed? Any questions? Hearing none, Mr. Nigam, you may step down.
Thank you.
Mr. Sanderson, you may call your next witness.
Thank you, Judge. At this time, Montana Dakota would call Travis Jacobson.
Mr. Jacobson.
Yes, sir.
Were you on the line for my previous warnings as to perjury?
I was.
So you understand what perjury is and the penalties for it?
I do.
Understanding so, do you promise or swear that the testimony that you're about to give will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do.
Mr. Sanderson, you may begin.
Thank you. Mr. Jacobson, could you please state your full name and business address?
My name is Travis Jacobson. My business address is 400 North 4th Street in Bismarck, North Dakota, 58501.
And you are employed by Montana Dakota Utilities?
I am.
And what is your position with MDU?
I'm just going to default from the question just for a second. I just got a notice that said I need to reboot immediately. And it may be multiple, but I'm going to keep going. Hopefully, I'll be able to not do that. But my position is Director of Regulatory Affairs.
Could you briefly describe your educational background?
Yes, I have a Bachelor's of Accounting degree, and I am a certified public accountant.
And what has been your work experience with Montana Dakota?
I have been with Montana Dakota since 1999 in various capacities. I was in financial reporting and planning, and for the last 6 years, I've been in regulatory affairs.
And are you familiar with Montana Dakota's applications in these three cases pending before the commission?
Yes, I am.
And could you describe your personal involvement with these applications?
My primary responsibility was around the revenue requirement that supported the retirement decision that was supported by the IRP.
In as part of the application, did you prepare and pre-filed written testimony in that case?
I did.
And if you were asked those same questions as in your pre-filed testimonies, would your answers today be the same?
Yes, they would.
Okay. Can you provide the commission with a general overview of the results of the revenue requirement analysis performed for the Heskett 4 project?
Sure. So Darcy talked about running the IRP and the modeling that they do in his shop to determine the most economical choice for projects on a long-term basis. And my involvement came in when the IRP and the modeling chose the Heskett 4 option, as well as to retire the Lewis and Clark Unit 1 and Heskett 1 and 2. So what we did is we said the modeling shows us the best economic choice. However, what we would also like to do is to try to get a better handle on the impact to customers of that decision. So we really broke it down into a number of steps. The first step was, if we continue to operate Heskett and Lewis and Clark units, what would that estimated cost to continue operations? So that was our first analysis. The second part was to determine if we retired them, what would the analysis look like to run Heskett 4? And then on top of that, to recover over our under-collected depreciation expense or the accelerated depreciation expense, as well as the anticipated employee retention packages that would need to be in place to allow those units to operate until the end of their life. The next step then was to compare the fuel cost scenarios between continuing operations versus a full dispatch of the units under a retirement scenario, and including also any capacity requirements that would need to be replaced because of the units being retired. Commissioner Fedorchak had asked why Heidel, his analysis showed about 50% less savings than Montana Dakota's. And Darcy touched on them, but I'll just maybe expand on that just a little bit. So Mr. Heidel used the ADP and the pricing in there to determine the savings for the fuel side. He ended up with a really not a significant difference, but a couple million dollar difference in the fuel side. And that was really driven by, he used this higher level ADP MISO number versus a full redispatch of all Montana Dakota's units. So it was, the analysis we did was more robust. So that really put the savings in, that's why that savings was slightly different. The most significant piece was we chose a 15-year period, and we did that for the purposes of analysis only. Mr. Heidel chose only to run the accelerated depreciation, the recovery of that, through the original anticipated ending life. So his shortened it significantly, and that was really the main driver in that reduction to the revenue requirement.
Now, Mr. Jacobson, Commissioner Fedorchak asked a couple questions earlier, and specifically were going to be directed to you. I thought we would take an opportunity to address those. The first one being, why is there not more money that has been set aside for decommissioning?
So I agree with Commissioner Fedorchak in that typically decommissioning is part of depreciation rates for all accounts at Montana Dakota and likely most other companies. In Montana Dakota's case, the decommissioning specifically for power plants, as I understand it, and this was decades ago, was disallowed by the commission. And so for years and years, we never recovered anything. In our last electric rate case, we did go in and we had decommissioning studies and we supported those. Through the process of settlement, we did recover some decommissioning, but not the extent that would have been required to cover all of these units. So that would be really the main reason why. And we are currently collecting some for our coal-fired units, and for our wind units, we do recover up to our current study levels in those particular situations.
And then somewhat paraphrasing Mr. Jacobson, the kind of question or concern, why are we bringing this Heskett 4 project now instead of a rate case? Can you kind of address that concern?
And I think it really comes down to timing. And that timing is, you know, the Darcy supported that this decision really came out of one of the earlier IRPs. Our analysis took place really during 2018 and early 2019. And the decision was made in February of 19. The challenge we have is the impact to the revenue requirement really won't begin until the first unit ceases operations in about a year from now. So it really comes down to the timing of putting all this together, and really also it hinged on not being able to announce the retirements until that decision was made because of the accounting implications of that announcement. I will say that our group is currently in the process of analyzing the North Dakota electric operations, and at this time, we're anticipating filing later in 2020. And again, the challenge is we'll have some savings that are going to be offset with some increases, and it's really managing that in relationship to all of the other items that are all the other activities that are taking place on the distribution side, transmission side, et cetera.
Now, Mr. Jacobson, I want to turn and the focus of the next question to be on Montana Dakota's application in case PU 19-317. Can you give the commission an overview of Montana Dakota's application for authority of the deferred accounting?
Sure. As I mentioned, the announcement of the retirement of the three units triggered some requirements under GAAP on the accounting side. And so Montana Dakota is currently using the depreciation rates that were approved in Montana Dakota's last electric case. That said, the accounting requirements under GAAP require that at the date of the announcement, from that date until the retirement date, you have to fully accelerate your depreciation to reach a net plant balance of zero. Likewise, on some of the employee incentives, retention incentives, and those type of arrangements, they have to begin being recognized throughout the period of that interim between the announcement and the retirement date. So with that in mind, Montana Dakota came in to the commission to request to defer that incremental depreciation expense, as well as those employee retention incentives and other related costs to be determined the regulatory treatment in a future rate filing.
Now, Mr. Jacobson, you're aware that on March 30th of this year, Montana Dakota and advocacy staff entered into a settlement agreement, which included the recommendation that the commission adopt a deferred accounting for the Lewis and Clark 1 and the Heskett 1 and 2. Do you support the joint settlement and request that the commission grant the deferred accounting order?
Yes, I do.
All right. Mr. Jacobson, I have no further questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Armstrong.
No questions. Thank you.
Mr. Shue and Mr. Lean.
I do have a quick question, Travis. Now, in the settlement, it states that there's a 15-year amortization period for the depreciation expenses, the decommissioning costs, and a 5-year period for the employee retention package. Why set an amortization period for deferred accounting in the first place?
So in our analysis, we chose a period to show at the onset of this, what we tried to do was to see what the customer impact would be. Mm-hmm. And so I agree that I don't know that the 15-year period is something that would necessarily be defined. However, it was supported. For the purposes of the analysis, that was how Montana Dakota had presented it. And Mr. Jeanson had supported that. So I believe that's why that was in there. He felt that was an appropriate time frame of recovery.
Sure. And why would that be an appropriate time frame?
So when we did our analysis, we broke it into two buckets. One of those being the employee retention side, and the other one being the accelerated depreciation.
Sure.
The reason we chose the 5 years for employees versus the 15 years was really, there's a distinction on, one of them is property, plant, and equipment related. So in general, there's a longer time frame. There's an associated return on it. And the other side, the employee side, is it's O&M related. Generally speaking, there's a quicker turnaround. So that was the main driver in how we set up our analysis. Again, more so for demonstration purposes initially, but it was supported by the intervener.
Sure. So we had short. I'm trying to grasp this. The with accelerated depreciation, we ended up with a regulatory asset that there will be a return component on. Correct.
That's correct.
Okay, and that period, and that will be amortized over the next 15 years. However, had there not been accelerated depreciation, that would have been depreciated out by when?
See, and I think this gets to where Mr. Heidel had said it should be a shorter amortization period because the plants would have ended at 2025. So his analysis showed a shorter time frame, and essentially he's saying you would have paid it through from now until 2025. So therefore, that's the appropriate time frame. So in a perfect accounting world, these plants would have been fully depreciated in 2025. And again, to your point, that would have shortened that amortization period.
Well, to the extent that we wouldn't set this, say, for example, the commission chose not to accept these amortization periods, but the rest of the settlement, ultimately, that was still, and it wouldn't really matter, would it? Because at a later date, you'd be able to, the point where you're requesting the recovery, that is probably a date then you would probably be able to set an amortization time as well, right?
I agree.
Okay. And if they didn't accept these amortization periods and at a later date wanted to evaluate it at that time as they have the expenses in front of them, you wouldn't have an issue with that, or MDU wouldn't have an issue with that?
I would probably have to confer with them, but I think the amortization period would certainly be something that would be negotiable, yeah.
Those are the questions I have, Judge.
Commissioner Crotchis.
All right. Good afternoon, Travis. You had referred to the 2013 IRP, I believe, at the beginning of your testimony. And is it safe to say that the company MDU is heavily reliant on that particular IRP in terms of the direction you take?
Well, I think in terms of the retirement of the units, the retirement of those units has been actually in a number of IRPs. When I referred to it, I guess where I was kind of going with that is that the unit Heskett 4 was ultimately picked, and it was supported to some extent by the 2017 IRP. So one thing, and I think Darcy would probably answer this better than I do, but the IRP is really, it's a snapshot in time. And Darcy's group continues to analyze in between the 2013 and the 15, the 15 and the 17. So I think we use the IRPs for a number of things, but the starting point of the process, and ultimately it was supported, you know, more fully in our 2019 IRP, which include the settlements, or the retirements, I should say, of the units as well.
Okay. Well, related to that, would you... I wasn't with the commission in 2013 or 2015. But would you say this has generally been headed in the same direction for a number of years?
That's a question that I'm not sure I could answer.
Your voice was lost to us, Mr. Jacobson. Please hold on a second. Commissioner Crosses, can you hear me? If you can, please wait.
We lost our audio. Can you tell them to hold off, please?
Yes, sir.
I understand that we're back on the record and everybody can hear me and everyone is back. The time is 5:33 and we were in the portion of the hearing in which the commissioners were questioning Mr. Jacobson, and it was Commissioner Crosses. And after your first question, we lost you, and that's you were talking a little bit about not being on the commission at a certain time in 2010. And if you can just pick up after that first question, it'd be appreciated because we lost you there for a little bit.
Okay, I will do that. And welcome back, Travis. So to be perhaps more concise, would it be fair to say that throughout the years, MDU has attempted to more effectively address decommissioning costs for the facilities in question?
Commissioner Crosses, I'm back. If you can't hear me, I'll switch to a handset, but I'll try this for now. I would say that we have recently tried to do exactly what you're saying, is to get more current on that. And I did mention on the wind side, we have used the studies on that now for the last several years.
Okay, and I think the other question I was asking related to that might be better suited for another time, but I think it would be smart on the commission's part to go in and just review assets for various utilities to see where we're at on those, but not related to this specific case. The other question I had was, or the next one, what would you say in terms of, even though gas pricing itself isn't a significant portion of the overall expense because the plant's not going to be running all of the time, it is an expense. Nonetheless, what's the likelihood, in your opinion, that gas pricing would spike?
Commissioner Crosses, I'm certainly far from an expert on gas pricing. My understanding and in my role, I have been quite involved with our purchase gas adjustment, and you know, from everything that we see, long-term gas pricing, particularly in this region, continues to point to stable gas prices. You know, we typically, our company is able to secure summer pricing that is extremely favorable. Again, I'm far from an expert, but in my role and my experience, we have seen very stable pricing, and all indications are pricing will remain relatively stable in terms of being in that lower end of the price range.
Okay, so odds are there are no guarantees, of course. We don't know what the future will actually be until it occurs, and then it's no longer the future, it's the past. But low likelihood, not an impossibility, but a low likelihood. Would you agree with that?
I would agree with that. There are certainly events that may trigger, you know, short-term price hikes, and we have seen that more so in the eastern part of our service territory. But certainly those are, you know, certain events can trigger pricing, but I agree with what you said.
How significant would a price spike for energy, oil and gas, what type of an impact would that have on transportation costs for coal to your facilities if that should occur and they were still in operation? Or is that fixed pricing you're locked in regardless?
Well, I believe Darcy mentioned a little bit in terms of when the question was, why are Heskett and Lewis and Clark towards the upper end? And certainly during the early part of the Bakken, we had some transportation contracts on our coal, particularly out in the Lewis and Clark, where those are all trucked in. And there were surcharges that needed to be placed because of the higher fuel. I believe the rail also experienced some increases, however, not as significant. So certainly high oil prices would tend to drive your coal contracts to a higher level. I don't know that it's a particularly linear relationship, but it certainly would add to that cost, I would expect.
Okay, thank you. I have no other questions.
Commissioner Christman.
Hi, Darcy. Hi, Travis. The earlier testimony, as I recall, you said something about Mr. Jeanson being in support of the combination of the 15-year amortization for the decommissioning costs and for the accelerated depreciation, and 5 years for the employee retention costs. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
How do I align that with, in his testimony from February 20th, on page 10, he mentions agency insisting that permission to defer a cost for accounting purposes not carry with it any promise that the cost will later be allowed in rates, nor if allowed in rates, that the unamortized balance will be included in rate base.
Just a second, Commissioner Christman. Let me take a second.
Did you find it on page 10?
Yes, there he's quoting something that was in a public utility report. And I believe later, that he talks about, so on page 11, he talks about, you know, granting the deferral. And right off the top of my head, I think there's another area where he talks about that he felt the time frame was reasonable. And so that's on page 15. More so here, he's referring to the decommissioning, but on line 6 of page 15, he talks about the projected decommissioning costs, and then on the subsequent line, he says, consequently, in my opinion, the amount of the decommissioning for the company has requested is reasonable, and the rationale satisfies that deferral, and he talks specifically about the 15-year amortization period.
Okay.
So, and I guess I'll follow that up. Mr. Hsu had asked, you know, are we set on the 15-year period in the settlement, and if that were to be removed from the settlement, would that be of great concern to the company? And, you know, at the time I stated I did not think it would be, and I did visit with our group, and, you know, they did agree that, again, as I kind of pointed out, what we had done is you need to start with something. And we picked a 15-year and did it for the presentation purposes. You know, from the company's perspective, certainly a shorter time frame, and that was what was pitched by Mr. Heidel. It would reduce the annual savings, but it would extinguish that accumulated, accelerated, deferred depreciation as well. So, I don't think that would be a concern for the company if that were something shorter than 15, for instance.
Okay, because that's just something I want to investigate some more, because it does seem like that is a long period for the amortization. And to say that people 15 years from now are the ones getting value for that. So we'll look into that more. The only other thing that I wanted to ask about is, am I, because now working from home, it's not as easy to access the redacted testimony. Did I miss something earlier that would have detailed the accelerated depreciation items at each of these, you know, what those things were and when they were added?
I don't believe there was anything confidential in terms of,
if not, maybe it just hasn't been filed, and I guess I'm interested in that. But what are these things? It's quite a substantial amount of money for facilities that are pretty old, and Darcy mentioned, you know, kind of a very general assessment of some of the costs, and that a lot of it was at Lewis and Clark. But I guess if it's possible, I would appreciate a little bit more detailed list than that, and when the additions were made.
And just to clarify, so what you would be looking for is the K capital additions that we made to the plant that were laid out in here?
Correct. That's come up to the, what is it, $54 million, I believe it was.
Okay. And, you know, and Darcy had mentioned that the main driver in that was the environmental project at Lewis and Clark, which was, I'm sure, a third of that amount. And in addition to that, there were some other projects at Lewis and Clark and then a little bit at Heskett. But we can provide a more detailed breakdown of the timing of those and the amounts as well.
I would appreciate that. And I don't believe I have any other questions. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Any redirect, Mr. Sanderson?
No,
Judge. Julie hasn't gone yet.
Oh, yeah. I apologize. Commissioner Fedorchak.
I just have one question, because I think that last question of Randy's was an important one. And but I wanted you to go back, Travis, and talk a little bit about doing it this way versus in a rate case. I know you did. You talked a little bit about that at the beginning with Mr. Sanderson, but I need to hear it again.
Okay. So I guess the main issue is the time frame. So what we have traditionally done in a rate case is we have taken a base year and then a bridge year and a projected test period, and we line all those up, and our goal then is to get rate relief, rate recovery, rate changes that match up with that projected period. If you think about how this is all going to unfold, we started working on, and it really was in conjunction with the 2019 IRP, but between the 17 and the 19 IRP, Darcy's group went through. As we continue to close in on dates, we start to refine that analysis more and more. So a lot of the work was being performed during 2018. The decision was made to retire the plants in 2019. And as I stated, that would have been an awkward situation in a rate case, because upon announcement of the retirement, there are certain triggers from a GAAP accounting perspective. And so the announcement has to be made before, you know, a lot of other things. So all that being said, so then during 19, we made the decision the plants aren't going to close till 21 and 22 with the replacement in 23. So you're really looking at, you know, developing a plan way back starting in 2018 for something that's going to impact rates through, in order to get your first full year of revenue requirement for all of these changes, you're really into 2024, because your plant is going to come online for a partial period in 2023. So, you know, I think it was supported in the testimony that some of this could be handled through a rider, the generation rider, which is something that we have. We currently just have our rice unit in it. And then I did mention, too, that our group is working with the other departments at Montana Dakota to develop a rate case that would encompass the generating units and all of the other operations and changes since our last case, where we put in rates. I believe that was in August of 17. So again, it's a very multi-year timeline, and really to get all of it lined up to kind of fit in the confines of a rate case, we just didn't see how that would work very well given the magnitude of some of the decisions in terms of their impact on other items such as the gap.
Okay, thank you. And does that, when you won't begin collecting, so on the Heskett, you won't start recovering that through a rider if this is approved, right? You still have to get that recovery approved.
Correct. So, for instance, we start some work on Heskett 4 this year, and we incur dollars, and we would like to get recovery of that on a quip basis, similar to what we did for the Big Stone project. That would be in a filing that we would make at some point down the road with some projected expenses and propose a recovery of that at that time. So currently, we do not have a mechanism to get any recovery on dollars spent on Heskett 4.
Okay. And deferred accounting amount, too, how do you envision that being recovered down the road? That would be after there's through a rate case at some point?
Well, I think there's some options there as well. It seems that it would be appropriate to line it up to some extent with a rate case. One of the mechanisms that was brought up in the intervener's testimony was to also put that in a rider. And I think what that would allow is both the company and the commission some flexibility in how that recovery is handled. For instance, if Lewis and Clark and Heskett were put into the rider today, and as those savings drop off, those would be real-time savings to the customer. And the flip side is, if there were to be some recovery of the accelerated depreciation, or the employee incentives, retention pieces, we would have some flexibility in maybe even matching that revenue reduction so the customer sees no change in rate. It would allow you to accelerate it or to decelerate it. So that would be one option. If it's in general rates, it's a little bit harder. And again, once you set rates, we don't go back and adjust them for things typically. So if it's in base rates, then we have less flexibility, and then it would really take another case for the customers to see any benefit or any additional cost.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I think that's it for me. Thanks. Appreciate it.
Mr. Sanderson.
Thank you, Judge. I have no further questions of this witness, but I would like to clarify with you what I have is Commissioner Christman requesting a late-filed exhibit for a more detailed list of capital additions made to the plants, and that we request permission to file that, within 7 or 10 days.
Yeah. I'll address that at the end of the hearing, because we do have a time for public comment, and so how all that fits together might need a little bit more discussion.
Thank you, Judge. With that, no further questions of this witness.
Mr. Armstrong, any questions?
No questions, Your Honor.
Mr. Hsu?
No questions, thank you.
Commissioners, any questions? Hearing
no more questions.
Hearing none. Mr. Jacobson, you may step down. Do you have any other witnesses to call today, Mr. Sanderson?
Your Honor, if I may, I'd briefly recall Darcy Nigam just to address a couple issues that were raised with respect to Mr. Jacobson's testimony. I only have a handful of questions for him.
Certainly. Mr. Nigam, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Be reminded that you're still under oath.
Yes.
Mr. Sanderson, you may begin.
Thank you. Mr. Nigam, you were present during Mr. Jacobson's questioning?
Yes, I was.
Okay. And during that, do you recall Commissioner Crotchis asking him about the 2013 IRP?
Yes.
Can you just provide some background? When did Montana Dakota include the plant retirements in its IRP?
So the 2013 IRP would be the first year that we looked at, you know, future, specifically coal plant retirements in our IRPs.
And back in 2013, what was your modeling selecting as a replacement?
It was selecting for the replacement of the coal plant retirements, natural gas-fired combined cycle generation.
And was that the same in 2015 and 2017?
Yes, it was.
Okay. Now, I now want to ask you, there was some questions about the timing of the Heskett 4 project now and in the future. Can you just summarize the rationale for construction of the Heskett 4 combustion turbine now instead of waiting into the future to construct a larger resource?
Yes. So as I've talked about before, and I think we've all, I think are probably in agreement on, is at least, you know, the small coal-fired plants we're talking about, like Heskett 1, 2, and Lewis and Clark, you know, are no longer economic. And it's not by a small amount, it's by a large amount that they're not economic. And so we end up seeing, as we've looked through some of the options, you know, available to us, and certainly, you know, when we look off to the future and where needs may come, a lot of those are driven by, you know, load forecasts. And again, that's on customers' aspirations, you know, to build things about they've told us. You know, a few of those that are out there are, you know, the Keystone XL pipeline certainly is one of those loads that's in our future load forecast. Some of the other ones are loads that are also some of the oil pumping loads that we end up, you know, have heard people talk about in eastern Montana or around the Bakken area. But again, those pieces are, you know, subjective in nature. They're still waiting to see if they come in. You know, we talk about Heskett 4, it is one of the most robust resources that I know of that we've ever modeled. You know, and as far as, you know, the right resource to pick and the timing, you know, I think it's sort of the thing that there's just a number of pieces that are lining up perfectly that says this is the best resource at the best time. You know, one of the things I didn't mention, we talk about the MISO's generator replacement, that if we wanted to build a larger unit, put it there, a Heskett 4, instead of being 88 megawatts, call it 150, you know, we have to go back into the queue for any generation that's over our current rights. So while we could end up with, you know, an 88 megawatt combustion turbine today that would perfectly fit in a replacement, the 150 we're going to have to turn around and are going to have to put 50 plus megawatts into the MISO queue that's subjected to all of MISO's timing and pieces. So the size certainly does matter, and it is a perfect fit, and it fits what our customers' needs are today. You know, when we talk about building combined cycle generation, you know, the key parts of that are simple cycle gas turbines. It's where the heat input comes from. And so, you know, we haven't ruled out that we can't build combined cycle over at Heskett. We're just doing it in more of a phased approach than we've talked about before. But, you know, the need for Heskett 4, you know, is driven by the need to retire the coal plants and a need for us to have an economic and reliable source of generation to replace it with that's inside our service territory. You know, and if it's over at Heskett, it's inside our largest load pocket that we have on our system. And the last comment I would end up making is, you know, the retirement of those units, you know, are small in nature to the entire MISO footprint, as is MDU's load. You know, so if we're retiring those resources off, it does not make a significant risk to the MISO market, where our load is, you know, less than a half of 1%, you know, as far as the total makeup of load that's in the MISO footprint. And so this is the most economic way to meet our customers' needs, is to build Heskett 4 now and rely on greater MISO purchases for the time being.
And Mr. Nigam, one of the things I think you said is, you know, acknowledging that the retirements are of the coal stations are prudent at Heskett 1 and 2. If there was a delay in construction of Heskett 4, Montana Dakota would run the risk of losing the MISO interconnects and the permits would potentially expire?
So we would have a three-year window to basically replace the Heskett 1 and 2 with Heskett 4. And some of that is timed upon when you make that announcement. You have to make when that's going to occur before you shut the unit down. The other one I mentioned on the permits is it'll look back at your five-year emissions, average emissions over the last 5 years in the netting. So if you've got a longer period of time, we shut them down now and we end up waiting 5 years, you're going to have 5 years of no emissions to netting, which says we have to spend the more capital intensive pollution control equipment as far as to put an SCR, you know, unit on the gas turbine.
Mr. Nigam, thank you. I have no further questions.
Are there any questions because of the questions that Mr. Sanderson asked? Mr. Armstrong.
No, Your Honor.
Mr. Shue.
None.
Commissioner Crosius.
No, Your Honor.
Commissioner Christman.
No, sir.
Commissioner Fedorchik.
No, thank you.
Since there are no further questions, you may step down, Mr. Nigam. Is there anything else that needs to be brought before me at this time, Mr. Sanderson?
No, Your Honor. At this time, Montana Dakota would rest.
Okay. Is there anything else that needs to be brought before me from anyone else at this time before we go to the public testimony portion of the hearing?
Your Honor, this is Mitch Armstrong. I need to call Victor Shook.
Okay. And is Mr. Shook on the line?
I am.
Were you here for my previous warnings as to perjury?
Yes, sir, I was.
So you understand what perjury is and the penalties for it?
I do.
Understanding so, do you promise or swear that the testimony that you're about to give will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
Yes, I do.
You may begin, Mr. Armstrong.
Thank you. Mr. Shook, where do you work?
I work for the Public Service Commission.
And what is your position?
I'm a public utility analyst.
And how long have you been a public utility analyst?
Approximately 5 years.
And what do you do in that position?
I process various procedural cases, rate cases, advanced determination of prudence cases, certificate of public convenience and necessity, essentially all manner of public utility-related types of cases.
And have you been appointed to advocacy staff in this case?
Yes, I have.
Can you give us just a brief summary of your educational background, your qualifications?
Sure. I have a bachelor's degree in accounting from Dickinson State University. Had a number of years of experience in reviewing financial statements, and as we previously said, 5 years' experience as a public utility analyst. And then in that time, I've reviewed nearly every type of case that we process and submitted testimony in those types of cases as well.
And you've been part of advocacy staff in this proceeding, which would include working with our experts, Mr. Heidel and Mr. Jensen?
Yes, that's correct.
I understand you have an opening statement you'd like to make to the commission?
I do.
Please proceed.
Okay. Good evening, commissioners. My name is Victor Shook, representing advocacy staff in this proceeding. I'm here today to support the settlement agreement between MDU and advocacy staff in case numbers PU 19-306, 19-307, and 19-317. When MDU submitted these filings, I was skeptical as to whether this was a prudent course of action. Closing down existing functional generators years early and replacing them with a brand new generator does not sound like something that will save taxpayers money. However, based on MDU's analysis and the analysis conducted by our experts, Mr. Heidel and Mr. Jensen, I find that doing so will lower overall system costs and therefore ratepayers' bills. The settlement grants an advanced determination of prudence for Heskett 4 up to a total expenditure of $68.7 million, excluding AFUDC. If MDU would exceed this amount with the total capital cost, it would need to come before the commission in an additional future proceeding for the overage to request a prudence determination of that amount. Both staff and MDU's analysis find that public's convenience and necessity will be served by the construction and operation of Heskett 4. As such, the settlement recommends the commission issue a certificate. And finally, finding that the requirements for deferred accounting treatment have been met, the settlement would grant deferred accounting treatment for the costs associated with the retirement of Lewis and Clark Unit 1 and Heskett Units 1 and 2. Excuse me. This does not set the amount of recovery that would be allowed, so that must be determined once the costs are known and measurable. For these reasons, I recommend the Commission adopt the settlement agreement. We look forward to addressing any questions you may have.
Your Honor, I tender Mr. Shook for questioning.
Mr. Sanderson, do you have any questions for him?
Just briefly, Mr. Shook, on the grant of deferred accounting, pursuant to the settlement agreement, Montana, Dakota, and advocacy staff agreed that the accelerated depreciation cost should be amortized over 15 years. Do you recall that?
That's correct.
And are you in agreement with that?
Yes.
Okay. I have no further questions. Thank you.
Mr. Hsu, any questions for this witness?
Yes. Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Shook, why are you comfortable that 15 years and not a shorter or longer period of time?
I guess, you know, we agreed to the 15 years in the settlement agreement. It was what MDU initially proposed, and by the sheer nature of the settlement agreement, I'm bound to support it. That's not to say that that's the only time period that it could be amortized over, but I do believe there is value for doing so over 15 years. There's value to future ratepayers in addition to current ratepayers, and that's kind of the reasoning behind spreading it out over a longer period of time. Essentially, the future ratepayers would receive the benefit of the unit going into place into service now versus sometime, you know, 5-10 years in the future when that unit would cost more money. So essentially, they're seeing some savings for that as well as current ratepayers, and that's why I thought it would be appropriate to pass it along over those 15 years.
I guess to that point, Mr. Shook, it seems that it could be pushing off the cost then to future ratepayers as well, though, since they would be paying more for something that's already has been accelerated, though, right?
That's correct.
Yeah. So, and you said there would be benefits to current ratepayers as well as future ratepayers. What would the benefits to the current ratepayers be?
We're going to see the fuel cost savings relative to the existing coal units for current ratepayers.
Okay. Wouldn't they say though see those benefits regardless if it was a 15-year or a 10-year or a 5-year?
Current ratepayers, yes. I agree.
Okay. So, I guess I'm trying to understand the policy reason behind a 15-year. I understand there's a settlement, and probably 15 years is fine. But if it did end up getting pushed off or of that specific provision removed, and would advocacy staff be comfortable then a different amortization period or addressing this at a later date?
Yes, we would.
Okay. I guess that kind of the next question kind of follows along with that. The in the settlement agreement, the company and the advocacy staff agreed that they could request recovery of the deferred expenses through the generation rider. So in the interim, they would be able to make requests as these, I'm assuming these expenses are known and verifiable through an annual rider then, correct?
Yes, they can. The agreement's written in such a way that it's not a must or shall, but they may. They may do so through the generation rider, request recovery, or through a standard rate case.
Just to explore that a little bit, what would be the benefit of doing it that way as opposed to just pushing it off to a later rate case?
I guess the benefit to riders is primarily with the company. But I do see some benefit to riders as well. You know, essentially we're starting to pay off those costs sooner than what may otherwise happen in a rate case. You kind of lower what those long-term cost impacts are to customers.
Right.
It's not to huge degrees, but there is certainly a benefit, in my opinion, to customers of starting that recovery sooner to reduce how much you pay over the long term.
Okay. So as these expenses are coming in, you know, and could be requested possibly through the generation rider, we might have a more tangible ability to review these expenses and evaluate the amortization at that time through a rider proceeding, or if not through a rider proceeding, through a request, but at a later rate case.
Yes, okay. Absolutely.
Okay. I guess one other question I have, and probably the last question, Mr. Shook, is one of the witnesses, Mr. Jensen of for advocacy staff, made the recommendation that to the extent that the company had excess earnings during this period of time in the interim, that they be used to offset the employee-related costs and or decommissioning costs subject to the deferred accounting treatment. That's not contained within the settlement agreement, is it?
It's not specifically spelled out in there, but it certainly doesn't prevent that either. I think the reason we didn't press to have that specifically in the settlement agreement, we don't believe it's terribly likely in the short term that's going to happen in an MDU situation.
Sure.
So it wasn't something terribly important to me at present.
Okay. If you were going to then, because you said it sounded like we could make that request later then. How would we go about actually getting that excess earnings and have those be then applied to employee-related costs or the decommissioning costs that are in that deferral if we don't do it in this settlement agreement on this date?
If it's not done on this settlement agreement explicitly, the company can always agree to something along those lines in a future proceeding. So even if we're let's say, in a rider proceeding in 2 years from now and there's excess earnings from 2019 or 2020, even that we want to capture in 2021 or 22, even the company can themselves agree to that at any point. Certainly for us to go back and do that in a future period would could be considered retroactive, but the company can always do so. And I think in the past, the company and advocacy staff have come to similar agreements.
Right. So
during those kind of rider proceedings.
Right. I guess it seems that the likelihood probably of the company coming back and providing the excess earnings to offset those costs in the future. I mean, I'm not saying that they wouldn't do that. But you say, of course, it would the burden would definitely be on advocacy staff to try to recover or to make an argument for that. And it would probably be a weak argument, wouldn't it?
It would be more difficult. I do agree.
Okay. All right. Those are the questions I have. Thank you.
Commissioner Crosius.
I don't have any questions for Victor at this time.
Commissioner Crispin.
I never got what I found to be a really satisfactory explanation to this scenario. We look at a plan here that ceases operation of the three coal plants by about March of 2022, and then add this peaking plant in about March of 2023. By design, leaving a whole year of buying both energy and capacity off the market. If that's fine for a year, why isn't it fine for two or three years? And perhaps the addition of the peaking plant just isn't even all that necessary.
I guess there's, a number of reasons. I thought Darcy kind of covered this to a certain degree, but I guess from my perspective, there's a lot of uncertainty in relying on that market for capacity. Energy, certainly, MDU in particular has relied relatively heavily on the market for their energy needs for their customers for quite some time, and I think it's worked out well. So I'm pretty comfortable with relying on the market for energy. Capacity is another thing. That market is a lot more volatile, and particularly now when there's so much uncertainty. Prior to the even the COVID-19 issues, there was a lot of uncertainty in what's going to happen with capacity prices and market in general with wind PTCs expiring. The queues are backed up in both of the regional RTOs in this area. There's just so much uncertainty in there. Guys, I wouldn't be comfortable with them trying to game the system or pass it on for any more years than necessary.
Then why are we comfortable with doing it for a year when I clarified, unless I misunderstood something, I clarified the
construction area. It's not like they need to first tear down units 1 and 2 in order to make room for unit 4. It's on the opposite side of unit 3. If it's not good for 2024, why is it okay for 2023 or vice versa? I just am failing to get that.
Sure. I guess, like I said, you know, a 1 year period doesn't scare me quite as much as a 2 or 3 year period. You know, off the top of my head, I guess I couldn't tell you the exact reasons, you know, why they can't line this up better, whereby, you know, we shut off HESCA units 1 and 2, and then, you know, a month later we turn on HESCA 4. You know, certainly some of that is going to be in the timing of, you know, they kind of keep those dates a little bit fluid. You know, we're not getting, you know, I think right now the company was saying March of 2022 was when they're going to shut down Lewis and Clark. And I may have that wrong. There's been a lot of dates floating around my head this afternoon. But I thought it was actually a little bit earlier, like January, the first time we started hearing about this from the company. So I think that date is a little bit fluid. And most likely the company's being a little cautious with their date of when they think HESCA 4 would be online as well. You know, that's kind of allowing for, I would imagine, some construction delays and things of that nature, when in all likelihood it could be done, you know, let's say January, February, if not even, you know, late in December. You know, I think we've seen that those kind of scenarios play out before with other resources that are being built, where we're expecting them in Q1 of a particular year, but they show up in the fourth quarter of the prior year.
Sure, and I should understand that these things don't come down to the hour or day or even week or month necessarily. But again, it just seems like if this unit 4 is needed, and I do think too that originally the closure date for 1 and 2 was like in January or something, has been pushed back to March, and I think even there was an explanation provided one time that it was to get through those cold months. It would seem to me that if Unit 4 is needed, we would be at least trying to enter a planning period here whereby 4 would then be done within a few months in preparation for the summer heat cycle. And that then, at least if it were late, it would likely be done for the following winter's cold cycle. But instead, like, we don't even think we need it. We're not even planning on getting it done until after the following year's cold month.
Sure.
It just seems to me to suggest a big question in the importance or reasonableness of adding this facility at this time.
Sure, and I can absolutely see that perspective. I mean, you know, I think the, you know, MDU certainly needs it for capacity purposes within, you know, for to meet their MISO load obligation along with their reserve margin. But probably from a regional connectivity and reliability, it's maybe not quite as necessary when you look at it from that perspective. You know, with in kind of the area that this is in North Dakota, there's a whole lot of connection to, you know, kind of the coal fields of North Dakota and all the power plants that come out of it. So in the event that you take, you know, 100 megawatts, or in this case, you know, we're kind of floating 88 megawatts for a summer period and a winter period as well, there's more than enough capacity coming out of the other existing North Dakota coal units, as well as all of the wind units in the area as well.
Okay, thank you.
Commissioner Fedorchuk.
Thank you, Victor. To follow up a little bit on Randy's questions, did you talk with them, or did they even model the possibility of purchasing capacity on MISO until they needed the resource in 2024, 5, or was that not part of the modeling?
I don't believe we did that modeling. I don't believe we requested it. I'm trying to recall in the between the data requests and the, I know it wasn't in testimony. I'm not sure that the company modeled that or not. I think if we wanted to be certain on that point, we should get a late file from them to cover that point. I'd be kind of be shooting from the hip at this point a little bit.
Okay. If they, is it a sure thing that they need that? Will be needing that in 2025?
I think based on the reasonable forecast of their capacity and at that time, I believe so. I mean, there's no
something
certain,
else
you know,
retire. Does something else retire that causes that, or is it load growth?
I believe it's the retirements of, you know, between Lewis and Clark 1 and Heskett Units 1 and 2, we're actually losing more than 88 megawatts.
So they think the load growth combined with the gap will be big enough, then at that point they'll need to fix it with another capacity resource.
Well, I'm not sure if I'm saying this correctly. So Lewis and Clark 1 plus Heskett 1 and 2, I thought I had written this down somewhere. I think we are in the neighborhood of 100, 105 megawatts. I don't think that's the exact number, but it's 100, let's just say. Lewis and Clark, sorry, too many different units here. Heskett Unit 4 is only 88 megawatts. So they are replacing 100 megawatt of capacity with 88 megawatts. And then I think that kind of follows with the, at present, or in 2020, I believe the company was going to be long a small number, to a small degree. I'm trying to recall how many it was, but let's just say it was 17 megawatts long. On their capacity obligations. So you take the 100 minus approximately 17 of their excess, and, you know, their needs are pretty close to lining up with this 88 megawatt unit. So hopefully that helps a little bit.
Yeah, but it doesn't create any sort of a gap for needing more down the road. So that's where I just feel like, in terms of why does this make sense now, because they have the capacity need now because, or, you know, more immediately during the present time, and the future one is less certain. So sure. Why would you give up the MISO, the interconnection, and some of the permitting, air quality permits, which have a significant value to ratepayers, only to have to replace those down the road when you know you're going to need to, you know, add a capacity resource?
I don't think we're.
I mean, that's what I
that's...
heard today.
Okay. I guess I'm seeing it kind of the opposite again there. We may be losing a few megawatt value of capacity and, you know, the air permits and things like that, but I think the one of the main reasons the company is locating this at the location it is they can capture those, that existing interconnection and utilize the emissions from,
that's
from
what
that
I just,
area.
I'm sorry, I was saying that. That's what I just thought I said. I was trying to counter what Randy's conclusion was just
okay,
a minute ago.
I'm sorry.
That this is not the place, like, we could just wait. This is the timing. And so I'm trying to understand if what I'm hearing and you, what you believe to be true, the rationale for doing it now.
Certainly.
Is that those things that they do have a capacity need now with the retirements. And
okay.
Why would you give up those high value? I want to say, wasn't it upwards of $20 million worth of value, those interconnect, and I thought it was like 14 potentially for the interconnection, and I forget the exact amount, but it was millions of dollars in value. For why would you give those up and
absolutely
buy off the market only to have to replace them down the road at a much higher cost to consumers and ratepayers.
Yes, so I would absolutely agree with what you just said. Those are compelling reasons. Sorry, I found what you were just talking about, and it's not it. That's our the $20 million was our estimated saving net benefit to our ratepayers.
Yeah, I was just there was a in some place a value to the interconnect. You know, if you were to go greenfield, you know how much you're saving. I can't remember what that was, but
there are numbers, and honestly, I get a little skeptical with those numbers because they can vary wildly. You know, it can cost as little as, you know, let's say $100 per megawatt, or you could have $400,000. It really just depends on where you are located, what your queue is doing, and it probably the larger than that is the time frame that it's taking. So I don't disagree. It has a significant value to ratepayers, both the interconnection and those emissions. The specific amount, I guess I would find a little questionable, but certainly it's significant.
Yeah, and you pointed out another good fact is that the capacity market is not real flush, and the you know the excess capacity in MISO is shrinking, and there's a lot of retirements. So if everybody's looking to the market for capacity, that could get really expensive, and it doesn't feel like the North Dakota approach to go that route.
Right.
So anyway, all right, Victor, do you feel like this is the correct use for deferred accounting?
It's not the ideal use of it, certainly. You know, I mean, we really just, you know, finished up a rate case about 2 years ago with this company, and at that time they had very different plans for the retirement of those units. So, from looking through from that aspect, this isn't the ideal use. Is it an appropriate use? Yes, it is, in my opinion. You know, this falls within the guidelines and the laws governing deferred accounting. It just wouldn't have been my preference for it to play out this way. It would have been a little bit cleaner, in my opinion, had we had this in mind during the last rate case.
Right. Okay. I think that concludes my questions. Thank you, Victor.
Thank you.
Any redirect?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. If there are no further questions... and I don't hear any, you may step down. Mr. Armstrong, any further witnesses?
No additional witnesses.
Okay. Is there anything else that needs to be brought before the commission before we go to the public testimony portion of the hearing?
Your Honor, this is Paul Sanderson again. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if you would permit me to call Darcy Nigam as a rebuttal witness to address some of the issues that just arose in Mr. Shook's testimony.
If there's no objection, and hearing none, you may call him. Mr. Nigam.
Yes.
Be reminded that you're still under oath. Mr. Sanderson.
Thank you. Mr. Nigam, you were just present and listened to the questions of Mr. Shook?
Yes, I was.
Now, you heard a number of questions specifically regarding the discontinuation of the coal plants in March 2022 and the fact that Heskett 4 may not be online for a year until March 2023. Can you explain what Montana Dakota is doing and why there's that year gap and how the company intends to handle that?
Sure. So part of that, we've talked about winter in a couple different ways. You know, with the retirements of Heskett 1 and 2, when we say in March, which is our current target of 2022, we don't want to shut the units down in the winter, not because they're needed to serve customer load on a peak, but we don't want to shut them down in a place where we're starting decommissioning when it's cold and things are going to freeze up and we're going to have more problems. So the anticipation is to run through the winter season. And that's also one of the other drivers on construction for Heskett 4 is we kind of have to target things out so we're not building over a winter season as well. You know, and so we're currently positioning ourselves that we'll be making equipment purchases, you know, which I mentioned before, which will start next year, in that it takes, you know, up to a year to get delivery of some of this equipment. And so just to time out with the seasons and where we're at is kind of how the schedule lines up. And yes, as Victor was saying, you know, it is entirely possible that we might get done early, you know, as far as, you know, the end of 2022, as far as for when the unit potentially could be online and available for that winter season as well. You know, regarding capacity and having enough to meet our requirements, you know, we've already gone out and we have purchase capacity to bridge that year. You know, we did model what that cost would be in the model that Travis Jacobson talked about, the revenue requirement model. We had included in there a placeholder that capacity could cost us, you know, up to and as much as $4 a kilowatt month. We were able to buy that capacity for $1 and $1.25 a kilowatt month. So significantly less than what we were modeling in that revenue requirement model that we had put together. You know, the other one, we talk about retirements and the amount of capacity. You know, we have to look at what MISO assigns to those units for zonal resource credits. That's what we get credit for our load. You know, we're retiring away about 128 zonal resource credits, and we're adding back something that's closer to 78. So it's got a gap of about 50 zonal resource credits, you know, that we'll be looking at what's the best way to meet that, you know, as far as in the future, and that'll come out of our next integrated resource plan for 2021. You know, and we're also constantly updating our load forecasts. So depending where that drives, it'll say if that gap is the same or if it's more or if it's less.
And Mr. Nigam, can you briefly discuss, with respect to the timing, the end of the coal contracts and the savings that the company's looking at compared to contracting?
So the savings will be significant. You know, when we're talking about shutting down the plants at the end of coal, you know, we're eliminating all the fixed O&Ms and the requirements for fuel that we have. So the savings will be substantial as soon as that occurs. And we talk about buying capacity for a dollar a kilowatt month. You know, that's probably, you know, I'm ballparking, but probably somewhere in the neighborhood of about a tenth, you know, of what it would cost to continue to keep those plants running.
And even, Mr. Nigam, finally, even with the one-year delay between the discontinuation of the coal plants and the construction operation of Heskett 4, do you still believe construction of Heskett 4 is reasonable and prudent?
Yes, I do.
Thank you. I would have no further questions of this witness, Your Honor.
Any cross-examination? Mr. Armstrong.
No, Your Honor.
Mr. Hsu.
No questions.
Commissioner Crocius.
No, Your Honor.
Commissioner Crispin.
No, thank you.
Commissioner Fedorchek.
I do have one question, Darcy. Did you model not doing Heskett 4 and just buying capacity until a late time, buying capacity on the market until a later time where you would build the potentially build the combined cycle?
We did not, just because of the value that there is to build Heskett 4 now. You know, as we talked about, you know, the savings on the interconnection cost and also on the air permit. You know, and those costs on the interconnection, you know, it's really kind of the wild card. If you go in and have to do an interconnection study and build the unit, it all depends what you're going to get in the group study or with MISO, you know, on what you could get for numbers. And, you know, some of the ones we ended up seeing a wind project, I think it was in the news a while ago, you know, that network upgrade cost that they were getting from Southwest Power Pool for an affected system study was almost doubling the capital cost of their project, which basically killed that one.
Okay. Thank you. And then are there
can you convert this simple cycle to a combined cycle?
Yes, we can, and the project is being laid out to do that.
So is this, in that scenario, are the turbines, do you replace the turbines? Are they kind of wasted, or do you just convert those turbines and a lot of the existing equipment would be added on to?
We would be able to reuse all of the existing equipment. You know, all that you end up doing is you take the stacks, you know, off the end of the unit, so basically the tailpipe and the muffler, and you'll put a heat recovery boiler and a steam turbine that connects to them. But the turbines are still used. If we would build a combined cycle today, it would use the exact same turbines and the exact same layout.
Okay. Thank you, Darcy. Appreciate it.
Are there any further questions for this witness?
Yes, Your Honor. I do. It's Randy.
Commissioner Chrisman.
Thank you. That's something I had not been taking into consideration, Mr. Nigam, the potential transition of that into a combined cycle. What is your ballpark estimate of the cost to do that if this were built and operating as planned as a peaking plant, and then you decided to do the transition that you just described?
So one of the ways that our model works is it actually allows the model to pick the peaking turbine first, and then there's an incremental cost that goes with the combined cycle. And so one of the things that happens is building the combustion turbine is actually the cheaper part of the whole plant because it's more packaged and straightforward and has less other equipment and metal that's a part of that. The more expensive part is always what becomes the combined cycle. And so on a dollar per, you know, installed megawatt basis, it's probably twice the dollar amount for those additional megawatts. You know, the benefit is you don't have to burn any additional fuel. You basically get to get megawatts out of the heat that's coming out of the turbine that you're otherwise just sending into the atmosphere. So what we're talking about, if we put something on that's another 100 megawatts, it probably is a project that has a price tag that's close to $200 million to do that for the second 100 megawatts.
Okay. Thank you.
Any further questions for this witness? Hearing none, you may step down. Is there anything else that needs to be brought before the commission at this time? Mr. Sanderson?
Nothing from Montana, Dakota.
Mr. Armstrong?
Nothing from advocacy staff.
Okay. Then we're ready for the public testimony portion of the hearing. And I'm looking at Matt to double check. And he checked about 10 minutes ago, and there was nobody waiting. And we'll just be in a hold pattern here for about 2 minutes while he goes and checks. Okay. Well, there's no public testimony and nobody waiting in the queue there. So what we're going to do is we're going to have closing remarks, and then we'll move on to closing matters of the late-filed exhibits and proposed findings of facts and whatnot. So in closing remarks, does the applicant have any closing remarks?
Yes, just briefly, Your Honor. First off, we'd like to thank the commission for the hearing and you know, picking this back up after the technical difficulties here today. As we mentioned, Montana Dakota is seeking an advanced determination of prudence in case 19-306. The North Dakota law governing advanced determination of prudence is governed by 490516, and that the commission may order may issue an order approving the prudence of a resource addition if the commission determines that the resource addition is prudent. And should go on, subsection 7 of that statute provides there is a rebuttable presumption that a resource addition located in this state is prudent. So we begin with the premise that the construction of Heskett 4 is a prudent resource addition. The testimony that you heard from the witnesses today, including both Montana Dakota's witnesses and advocacy staffs, all support The decision that the construction of Heskett 4 is a prudent resource addition for Montana, Dakota. And based on the evidence presented at this hearing today, we would respectfully request that the commission grant an advanced determination of prudence for Heskett 4. Likewise, some questions were asked about, you know, the timing of this, and the case 19-307 seeks a certificate of public convenience and necessity, and that's governed by North Dakota chapters 4903 and 4903.1. Before any electric public utility may begin construction or operation of a public utility plant or system, it must first obtain from the Commission a certificate of public convenience and necessity. And the factors for the Commission to consider in granting or denying a certificate of public convenience and necessity are governed by 4903.104. And the Commission shall take into consideration the following factors: the need for service, the fitness and ability of the applicant to provide service, the effect on other public utilities providing similar service, the adequacy of the proposed service, and the technical, financial, and managerial ability of the applicant to provide service. Again, we believe the testimony presented at this hearing and all the evidence in the record, including the original application, the pre-filed testimony exhibits, all support that Montana, Dakota is able to successfully operate and construct the Heskett 4. There is a need for the service as identified in the 2019 IRP and in the testimony of the witnesses today, and Montana, Dakota certainly is fit to provide the service at the existing Heskett 3 location. So for those reasons, we again would request, pursuant to the settlement agreement the parties entered, that the commission grant a certificate of public convenience and necessity for Heskett 4. And finally, we have the issue of the deferred accounting order. Under North Dakota Century Code 4905.16, subsection 6, it provides that a public utility may request an order from the commission for deferred accounting treatment for costs incurred for a discontinued resource addition. Montana, Dakota, and advocacy staff realized that pursuant to the generally accepted accounting principle rules that require it to accelerate depreciation in order to fully depreciate assets to their expected retirement date for financial reporting purposes. Both parties agree that Montana, Dakota has met its need and burden for establishing deferred accounting for the retirements of the three coal-fired generation stations, Lewis and Clark 1, Heskett 1, and Heskett 2. And, again, we would respectfully request that the commission issue an order authorizing deferred accounting for the retirement-related expenses of the three generating stations until the next electric rate case. And in conclusion, we simply request that the commission approve the joint settlement agreement pursuant to the terms based on the evidence and testimony presented at this hearing and in these applications. With that, on behalf of Montana, Dakota, we thank the commission for the opportunity to appear, and again, thank advocacy staff for their cooperation in reaching a settlement agreement in this case. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Armstrong, any closing remarks?
Just very briefly, thank you, commissioners. Thank you, Judge. Just want to... advocacy staff does request that the settlement agreement be approved, and we thank you for your consideration. That's all.
Commissioner Crosius.
Well, thank you, everyone, for grinding through the afternoon with the technical problems that we experienced, but I appreciate everyone's patience, and thank you for IT for getting that ironed out and coming up with a good solution to continue on so we could proceed and, as it turns out, wrap this up today. I thought the application overall held a significant amount of detail, and I appreciate that. I do have some more questions that would be better suited as we get into the work session phase of this particular case, or the three cases that are consolidated. So I withheld a couple of questions related to that just because I think we'd be better served once we're working with staff on addressing some of those. But one I would mention in particular would just be the length of time in terms of the depreciation schedule for the the undepreciated portion of the facilities, stretching that out to 15 years. But again, that is something that can be worked through. But thank you to advocacy staff. Thank you to advisory as well, and just the entire staff at the commission. And then thank you to the company as well for, again, I thought a very strong level of detail, and I do appreciate that. Thank you, everyone.
Commissioner Christman.
I just want to point out there was an article, I believe it was E&E News, that highlighted some work that this agency did regarding a siting case, but then highlighted a lot of regulatory agencies around the country that are just putting things on hold during this whole coronavirus situation. And so I also want to thank everybody for helping here to make this kind of thing possible. I still prefer a traditional type hearing, but I think the most damaging thing is when everything falls by the wayside and slips many months into the future because of canceled hearings and things like that. So thanks everybody for working with our technology people and with us to get us the information that we need to make a good decision here.
Commissioner Fedorchak.
Thank you, everybody. I thought it was a great day, very productive, and a very good discussion on this case. There's so many changes going on in this industry and big things, and nothing is ever real simple. But I think you guys made a good case for this project and doing it in this manner, and I look forward to working through all the details and coming to a decision as soon as we can. So thanks so much for everyone's time and patience.
Well, we're on closing matters right now, and I'm going to first ask Mr. Sanderson. Right now we have the record staying open till May 11th, 2020, for written testimony from the public. You probably want some time to respond to that if need be. Plus, we'll need to have time by which joint findings of proposed fact, conclusions of law and order would be provided by. And then we have the issue of late filed exhibits. There's at least one. So with that, I would guess how much time do you want to add on to the May 11th to respond to public testimony? And then how much time would you need to come up with those joint findings of fact?
Your Honor, this is Paul Sanderson. With respect to the late filed exhibit, if I could start there,
okay.
I believe we could have that filed on or before the May 11th, 2020 deadline. I don't believe that'll be an issue.
Okay, and everybody sees one, that number MDU-7. It would be, I would label it as MDU-7. And it has to do with the timing and amount of capital improvements to the facilities. Correct, Mr. Sanderson?
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. Does anybody see any other late filed exhibits, or are we missing anything? Okay. And so we'll make a deadline of that of May 11th. And then as far as the joint findings of fact, conclusions of law, and whatnot, and the response, let's start with the response to the public comment. The public comment will be done on May 11th. Do you need some time then?
Your Honor, I would think in light of what we would likely expect if maybe we had till May 18th, a week to respond to any public comment.
Okay.
Now, with that said, Your Honor, I haven't had a chance to confer with our team about those dates. If any if there's any issues with these, you know, would reserve the right to possibly file a motion for an extension of time if something does arise.
Yes, and I understand, especially in these times of the COVID virus and whatnot, that things can change drastically in a second. So I'd be open to those requests for extensions.
And, Judge, then along those lines, with respect to our findings of fact, conclusions, I throw out May 29th.
Okay. May 29th. How about June 1st?
June 1st could also work.
Okay. And it can be before that if it so occurs, but... I think I looked at the calendar ahead of time, and that seemed to be a good date. So that I had written in my notes, so I'm going to go with that. Is there anything else that we need to discuss at this time?
Nothing from the applicant.
From the PSC staff?
Nothing, Your Honor.
Okay.
Nothing, Your Honor.
Well, it looks like if there's nothing else that needs to be brought before the commission, that we can close this hearing. It is approximately 6:50 p.m. on April 30th, 2020, and the consolidated hearing for PU 19-306, 307, and 317 is closed, and the record is held open for the aforementioned reasons. This hearing is closed.